and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 148, the last show before E3 begins. And as we said last week, John Lindemann could not be with us today. He's actually at a bachelor party and having a lot more fun than we are. But
or not.
along with James and Greg, we have special guest, first timer on the show, Luke Balicki.
Hello.
Did I say that pretty decently?
Well, my real name is Lucas, but Luke, whatever.
It was the last name he was more worried about.
Oh, Balicki. That's the Polish way.
Balicki. Okay.
Balicki, yeah.
Okay, cool. So Luke is, of course, Flames of Chaos from the forums. He's been on the staff for the past couple months, and he's writing a lot of news and starting to do some reviews, too.
Damn right.
Yeah, damn right.
No, I feel it necessary to take a bit of a meet the press moment here, if you'll indulge me. Lucas, just a matter of a few days into the new year, in a response to a talkback thread about this very podcast, you said this. Oh. Sorry, guys. After listening to some other podcasts and then listening to this one, NWR's podcast doesn't hook me anymore. It just doesn't seem entertaining anymore after listening to some other funnier and engaging gaming podcasts. Are we to take your appearance here that you've had a change of heart, or should we expect you to just drop the call at any minute?
No. It was just a little bit drier, like, toward December and January. But I think that you guys rejuvenated and have a better personality in the latter episodes and, like, the more recent episodes. So the show is getting more awesome again.
There's just more enmity amongst the cast now, so it works out much better.
Yeah, and it's always more entertaining to see James arguing with everybody.
With fate.
We swing back and forth between enmity and amnesty. Well, Luke, I'm glad you think things are improving now. And
oh, yeah, I feel validated.
Indeed. And you know, Greg basically just forced you to have a really, really good showing tonight, or else you're going to look like a big fat hypocrite.
Yeah.
No, really. Welcome to the show, and I wish you the best of luck. I hope you're going to do well. And
the vote of confidence there, Johnny.
Is that my death threat? Is that my death threat, Johnny?
No, it's just a challenge. Step up.
All right.
Step up or step out. Before we jump into new business, I did want to cover our E3 plans for the show a little bit. I'm actually just a couple days away from flying out to LA, and James is too.
Yeah.
And so what we are planning to do next week is that we will be recording, I hope, daily podcast from the expo, or more likely from the hotel. But I'm hoping to do smaller shows every day. That's going to be tough to fit in because we're so busy, but I really want to do that. And James and I will probably be on every episode, and then we'll be rotating in other people. We have a crew of about 10 or 11 people at the show, and I'm going to give some people a chance. We'll have people like Neil and Nick who have some experience, and we'll get some first-timers on there as well. So I'm hoping that we'll have a lot of really cool E3 impressions and news reactions and, you know, general bewilderment at being at E3. For all of you to listen to next week. So that's the plan. These will be unnumbered episodes, meaning we won't have episode 149 next week. We'll have a special series, and we'll come back with 149 the week after E3, and then the week after that we'll have something relatively special.
we haven't thought of it yet.
For episode 150.
There are somewhat more pressing concerns ahead of us.
Yes, exactly.
Self-referential, indulgent nonsense.
There's nothing more important than that.
I haven't put much thought into 150
we'll
just
think of something.
Yet. That's something I will deal with on the way back from E3. But it's not going to be a four-hour massacre like episode 100 was.
Thanks fucking
it was two
God.
Episodes, basically, that one was.
Yeah,
plus,
basically.
In fact, because you had the reel at the end as well.
This, the exactly. What, 20-minute reel of me just dicking around for a while? Yeah, pretty much.
Anyway, we're not going to do anything quite that extravagant, but it is our 150th anniversary or episode coming up, and it's about the third-year anniversary. This show was originally started by Mike and Evan just a week or two after E3 2006, so it falls right into place, and we're going to try to do something special, but I don't know what yet. So anyway, with all that out of the way, it's time for new business, And we didn't really do this last week, so we got a bit of catching up to do. Luke has a lot of catching up to do. James, I don't know what the fuck you're going to talk about. So
I like it that way, because I like to make it up as I go along.
That's how it usually
is. If you say Rune Factory Frontier, I'm going to cut you out of the entire show.
Well, look, it's not what I'm going to talk about, but I am still playing it.
Okay, good. And what else?
So I bought a couple of DS games with the thought of I'm not going to play them until I get on the plane. And I've completely broken that promise already because one of them, Greg knows that one of them should be.
Do I? I wouldn't have thought
I've talked
so.
Rhythm Heaven.
Awesome.
Which I kept telling you I'm going to get next week, honest.
No, but you had it the last time we spoke, so that's why I didn't think it was that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I hadn't played it. That was the... I'm going to hold on to it.
Yeah, you played it trivially. Yeah. So how's that go? How are you finding it relative to the other one?
It's funny because I was like, this is really easy, but I don't remember getting this pissed off when things get hard as I did in the other one.
Mm.
So it feels like sometimes the DS interface, because it's more digital than just buttons, sometimes that gets in your way a little bit more.
The thing with it is that it can feel that way, maybe even if it's not, you know what I mean? Because there's more ambiguity about it. You're just not so sure whether it's like you're messing up the beat or whether you're messing up like how you do a flick.
Right.
Or whatever. So that whole element just kind of makes it a little less immediate.
And the one that's really been getting to me on that one is, I think it's called Love Potion.
Yeah, the one where you throw the bottle.
Yeah, and you have to shake it right in the right beat pattern. Yeah. And for whatever reason, my shakes, I have to go really exaggerated on there to make it work.
Really? I didn't... It's only a couple that do that, right? Which is the lizard one.
The lizard one, yeah. But the lizard one's really easy, so it's okay.
Yeah, I guess it is, isn't it?
Yeah. In fact, it's the first one I perfected.
So, in other words, you were ready for that jelly.
So, I think the problem with the game that I've been having is just getting used to using the DS interface. And I think that's actually been harder than the games themselves. I'm on, like, I think the fifth set now of games. Yeah. And that's where they're starting to get kind of hard.
They do, yeah. And I mean, I think really, though, it does kind of wait to ramp, like, right the way up until they get to where the games repeat, you know, where you get the second versions like that. And some of the remixes for those are, like, you know, definitely way more complicated.
And that's really what it was like in the original game, too, where you get to the first set, like, oh, this is nothing. The second set, it's hard. And then that third set is just unfair. Basically, it's like you hit the A button just slightly off and you're done. I'm trying to remember what the other game was that was giving me a lot of grief. Oh, the camera game. You have to take pictures of the cars.
Oh, the racetrack, yeah.
Yeah, that game screws with you because you're almost better off closing your eyes and playing it.
Yeah, that's the funny thing. The funny thing about Rhythm Heaven is I always love the kind of different ways the audiovisual kind of thing works. So sometimes, you know, it really, the audiovisual thing kind of really helps, or it's like pretty much kind of like essential in some ways to look and you know, because it'll give you a little, you know, sort of advance
like
notice.
Love Potion, that's a perfect example.
Yeah, exactly, where it will give you, you know, you need that. But on the other hand, sometimes it will deliberately try to mesmerize you with like a bunch of crazy stuff. Like, there's a number of examples of that, like Lockstep can get a bit like that. Lockstep, but that really just threw me for a loop the first time. I was like, I have to go off the beat? No. It like exposed some miswiring in my brain for quite a while. It's quite funny. I've got perfect on it now. It's like, I don't know why I thought it was so hard. But
yeah,
it's
really... How many perfects do you have?
I've got about 12 perfects and 40 medals at this point. So I've still
How
a long
big
way
is your
go.
Dick?
I got all the perfects on the Rhythm Heaven GBA. That's how big it is.
That's wonderful,
dude. That's pretty insane.
it was good fun though. It just that took a lot of months to do that. Very
yeah,
stretching across the Atlantic.
It's not a game that you can just play straight through, or
nah,
you will.
Nah,
you do
it in little bits and bobs as it goes on. Yeah, it's good.
Well, see what happened was I played it a little bit, and I'm like, okay, I'm done. Click. And then I came back, like, right before a remix, and that's a terrible decision.
because
like, how do I play these fucking games?
The thing, yeah, it's a good point, because, like, whenever you play an individual game, you get the little tutorial first, you can sort of get, you know, you can remember, like, what you're supposed to do if you've forgotten, or obviously if it's the first time. But with a remix, if you come into that having not played the component games for a while, you can kind of fox you a bit.
I'm not sure this is going to be a great great game to play on an airplane.
I'm not convinced of that. Yeah, well, because all the tapping as well. Like, yeah. Lockstep would annoy the hell out of your neighbor passenger on the plane.
Well, thankfully, most of my flight, I'm on a row by myself.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's nice.
One of those three-seat rows with dial down the middle.
Don't play DS. Stretch out and go to sleep.
If you can, yeah.
Everybody knows that I'm not... I don't have Rhythm Heaven. I'm not really into it. But I do kind of want to play your copy of it, James, at E3 when you have a minute, because... I'm curious to try it, but I have a feeling that once I get past the Glee Club, I'm going to get pretty pissed off at it very quickly.
Now, you'll get to the first set, I think, and then...
Yeah, they're pretty soft.
Luke, you have some experience with this series, at least, don't you?
I don't have the GBA one, but I have the DS one.
Okay.
The first game that really pissed me off was the Ping Pong Rally one.
Yeah. There's an incredible remix later on, which is all about ridiculous speed, which like keeps going back and forth to the
ping pong. Oh, wonderful.
That one's good fun.
That's another one of the ones where the visual helps you, but it almost mesmerizes.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, though. When they revisit that one, they switch it around, because then all of a sudden the camera starts rotating and it doesn't help you at all. So if you were relying on that, you are screwed. That's when you know, that's what I love about the interaction. It's like sometimes it sort of gets you to sort of think you're depending on it, and then it takes it away from you, and so I'll do it without that. You know, that's what's kind of, I think that's really clever about it. And then you realise, well, actually, you don't have to depend on it. It's a little like, was it Luke putting the blast shield down in Star Wars? You just gotta let it happen.
Have to use the Force.
There are actually some games that I have played not looking at the screen and done at least marginally well.
There's plenty. Once you really understand it, there's a number that I've found I've done better. Lockstep being one of them, definitely. Don't look at the screen.
Just don't. It's not going
to
help you.
Yeah, it's really good to tune out of the visuals and just to focus on the vocals and the beat. That really helps.
Yeah, it's all
a lot.
About the beat. Yeah, that is the whole game.
Yeah, because you're not really playing ping pong. You're tapping to a beat.
Kind of trying to put this veneer on it, like it's, you know, like you're playing ping pong. You're never, you know, you're not doing any of those things. You're just, you're being in time. That's all it ever is.
It's so weird. It's such a bizarre game to play if you're not in the right mindset, but when you are, it's just really fun for about 25 minutes, and then it's just anger.
It's a good handheld game in that sense. Like I say, I mean, the fact that it does make noise now to do the tapping doesn't make it such a good like public handheld game.
No,
as the old one, but you know, in general, it's a nice kind of handheld game to kill a little bit of time with here and there.
Right, and that's why, of course, I had to get a second game, which I got the third Phoenix Wright game, but I haven't played anything yet, so there's nothing to say there. But I got it knowing that I won't be able to play this game the whole flight.
Did you get it really cheap or something? Because, you know, they just announced the Prosecutor game for North America. So.
Yeah, I got it at a decent price. I never, for whatever reason, was never able to find the third one when it came out. And so I played the first two passionately. Then I begrudgingly played the fourth one out of order because I couldn't find the third one. So I was quite happy to find the third one.
I played the first one, and that was enough for me.
Oh, I loved those games. So
it's fine, but it wore thin even by the end of the first one, I thought.
The other thing I wanted to talk about isn't a game. It's the
It's a non-game.
It's a non-game. It is. It's an object. It's the Nyko wand, which sounds moderately sexual, but in fact it is more Fisher Price than anything else.
Speaking of something that sounds oddly sexual, in Majora's Mask this week, I got the rabbit hood. Move on, James. Please, continue. The wand.
There are a few things to discuss about this. First off, it is slightly lighter than the original Wii Remote, which may or may not be a good thing. But the buttons are fucking square. Now, this
well,
may
you know
not
what that is, don't you? That's the try to avoid getting sued.
Don't sue us, yes. Yeah. But...
But hang on. Is there really a patent on circular buttons?
I know, but I think it's just so they make it look more obviously different. With a lot of third-party things, you just end up getting like stupid-shaped D-pads and...
That is a patent thing.
Sure, but I think it's just even
round
though it's,
buttons, it's just a style.
It seems stupid, but I can't really think of any other reason other than just playing it safe.
There was a lawsuit against one of these third-party accessory providers.
It was actually with Nyko because with their first wireless nunchuck, they actually got sued by Nintendo because of how very similar it looks like to the original Nunchuck.
Just purely the visuals, right? In terms of like it was, you know, the similar curvature or whatever. So didn't they make it more angular the second time? Or
yeah, well, the first one,
it's hideous.
It looked like a Nunchuck. The only difference is the buttons were more transparent instead of white buttons, and everything, it looked like a carbon copy.
Well, they didn't do that here because the transparent A button you have on the Wii Remote, imagine that with a rounded square and red, because that's what you get with this sucker. It's a big red square.
Is there a reason why you have decided to investigate this?
It was a review copy we were sent.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, that makes more sense.
I fail to see the justification.
Well, the only way to justify it is if it's cheaper, which I assume it is.
I think it's $5 cheaper.
Oh fuck! It's not worth it.
There's your review,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's so trivial in the difference in quality. It's not
a terrible piece of hardware. The buttons don't have that satisfying click that you like on the Wii remote. But I mean, the B button does, the B trigger, but the A button does it, and the one and two buttons, eh. But the D-pad looks like the center of the New Mexico state flag.
Yeah, it does.
I just think the whole thing looks as ugly as sin.
And what was explained to me from someone who seems to like this remote is that the diagonals, it's supposed to act as diagonals, which it, quote, does better than the D-pad on the Wii remote, which is fine, except for the fact that that's not relevant about 89% of the time you're using the Wii remote. So it's not a huge issue, but it did get in the way a little bit in one of the games I was playing with it. So one of the big advantages this remote has is that not only does it vibrate, but if you get their... Well, I can't remember what the name of their nunchuck that goes with it.
Comma.
The comma, yes. It vibrates too.
Isn't that funny? The nunchuck looks like a comma, so they called it the comma, except they spelled it K-A-M-A.
Exactly.
Oh, good.
But
I really think that's where they got the name.
Yeah,
but
no, I'm sure
awful.
It is, but why would they... Why K? Why?
I think they're trying to be hip with that.
Yeah, what mid-90s hip?
The back of the Wii remote, though, has this weird little, like, electrical pad to accommodate the vibrating nunchuck. And all I could think, they didn't send us one, so I don't know how that works, but all I could think of is, why do you need a vibrating nunchuck? And I just kept thinking that the whole time, like, why do I need this? So I can't discern any advantage to having this thing, unless you're trying to save money. And this is going to be one of those weird reviews where I'm not going to budge on discussing money, or prices, because I think that's the only way it's a third-party accessory is really relevant. So I know normally we try to avoid discussion of price in our reviews, but I think this is going to be an instance where I'm just not going to avoid it.
You don't have to avoid price, but you can say it's priced lower than the first party Wii remote.
But it's not priced sufficiently lower than the first party Wii remote.
Yet.
Yeah, I'm hoping it breaks at some point when I bring it to E3.
Are you really going to bring this to E3?
I am going to bring it to E3.
God, why?
Because I only have two normal Wii remotes. I got to bring something.
I'll bring remotes, man. Don't do that.
But I do actually have... I am actually scheduled to be our representative at the Nyko booth for their event.
Good, you can return it to them.
Hey guys, you want this back? I'm done with it.
Don't ask, tell.
Just leave it there. Where'd this come from?
Hey guys, you want this back. All right, James is done.
Yes.
Luke, it is your new business.
All right.
Go.
So I'm going to talk about three games. My first game I'm going to talk about is Darkspire for the DS, which I'm currently reviewing. Darkspire is basically an old-school first-person RPG by a Japanese developer, and they actually nailed that part right perfectly. The problem with the game is that it's very sadistically hard. One unique thing about the game is it has two different graphical presentations, one called Modern and one called Classic. In the Modern presentation, all the graphics are cel-shaded, however, there is no animation at all. So instead of the animation...
Modern!
Yeah,
quotes.
Well, cel-shading is modern, guys.
So is animation.
I just love the idea that a first-person RPG could be modern. With no, I mean, I guess Oblivion and Fallout are first-person RPGs, but this is something completely different. It's like a maze game, right?
Yeah, you're pretty much in a labyrinth, and instead of animation, it gives you descriptive text of, like, he swings his axe hard as a giant gale comes through his axe, or something like that, and it makes the player imagine, which is awesome, since no game has to do that anymore because of all the graphic representation of everything. Also, another thing the game made me realize is how much grinding sucks. To grind to the next level, it took me about almost 2 hours just to get to the second level, which I had to return to the town and to the guild just to raise my level. And sometimes I just realized I didn't have enough EP points to raise to the next class level. So more grinding continued.
So you're saying it's like old school to a fault?
Well, yeah, like the game as a core, it's great, but it's obviously not going to appeal to everybody.
Or anybody.
Well, like, I guess D&D nerds or like those people who grew up on Wizardry will enjoy this.
I grew up on Wizardry.
Yeah, they will enjoy it if they want that old school experience.
Well, James, maybe this is your next purchase.
Shut up, Johnny, or I'll transform you into a monster.
Yeah, the nice thing about the classic graphics, it's basically a wireframe. The whole dungeon is a wireframe. And all the enemies are these low-grade 8-bit graphics. And also, to accommodate with these graphics, all the music are chiptune versions. One thing I did was I constantly flipped through the modern and through the classic just to see how accurate they have the modern music with the classic 8-bit chiptune music. And it's pretty accurate, and it's it really impressed me. Another cool thing is that Atlas, the game publisher, in each copy, they included a sampler soundtrack, and some of these soundtracks are the modern versions of songs and the classic versions of songs, and it's like a really nice bonus.
They've been doing that a lot lately.
Yeah.
They've been doing that forever, Atlas. I mean,
so who actually developed this title?
Success.
Anything that they have had success in developing?
They did both of the Izuna games.
Oh.
Which are Mystery Dungeons. Yeah.
I love Mystery Dungeons.
Which is why you'll never be allowed to review them.
All right. And also, I downloaded both of the new American games on the American WiiWare, Bubble Bobble Plus and Adventure Island The Beginning. I really liked Bubble Bobble Plus. The standard mode is basically a carbon copy of the NES game, and it has an arrange mode, which has 100 other stages, which is nice. Then there's the super mode, which are harder versions of both the standard mode and the arrange mode. The game is pretty cheap. It's actually in America, it's actually 200 Wii points cheaper than the European Virtual Console.
Take that, Europe.
What is it, 800 here?
It's 600 here.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, it's Bubble Bobble, Johnny. I mean, come on.
I know, but I just was figuring 800 for some reason. But for 600, I mean, I already paid 5 for the NES version.
It's 2,000 points for Bubble Bobble.
Yeah, so, and the game also has 2 downloadable content packs. Each gives 50 levels. There's one big problem with the DLC. In the game's menu, you'll see 2 modes grayed off, Expert Mode 1 and Expert Mode 2. And guess what the DLC is, guys?
Expert Mode 3.
No. They are unlock keys for those 2 modes. So in order to unlock those games, you have to buy them for 200 points each. And the file size for both of them are 1 block each, yeah. Which is awesome.
I assume they did the same thing with Mega Man 9 and with the endless mode, and you know, I mean, you just got to expect that at this point. And maybe that's what they were looking at, is in terms of, you know, bringing the whole package down to within 1,000 points, like 600 plus 2 lots of 200.
Yeah, but even if the whole game technically costs $10 with all the DLC involved, the expert modes are actually worth it since they're pretty challenging and fun. Yeah, and the game also supports online leaderboards, so if you're into that, you can just upload, and they actually have a special ranked mode where it's strictly to score for the online leaderboards. The difference between the regular modes and the ranked modes, in the regular modes you have unlimited continues, in the ranked modes you only have 10 credits to continue, and basically you go down the stages as far as you can with those 10 credits.
I find something patently ludicrous about competitive Bubble Bobble. But the most important thing for me is, how is the music?
It's basically like the NES one, except a little bit more modernized.
But is there still only the one song?
Yes.
Good.
Yeah, it's still addicting as ever.
Cool.
And like I mentioned, the other game I downloaded is Venture Island The Beginning. I personally thought the game was very disappointing, considering the fact that it's based off the first Adventure Island for the NES. The biggest issue I found, since I have my Wii set up to widescreen like anybody's saying with HDTV, the game forces a 4x3 presentation, meaning that you will see large borders on the left and right side, and that irritates
me. Yeah, so Mega Man 9 does this, doesn't it, as well?
But Mega Man 9 is an NES game.
It's still inexcusable. They still
the point. The point being, though, have you got a plasma, Lucas?
No, I have.
Because I know that, but plasma owners have a real issue with it forcing black borders, because like plasmas have issues with screen burning.
Yeah.
And so if it's just a 4:3, and then if you want to put it in 4:3 yourself, it'll put it in borders that are more plasma burning friendly. So that's why people don't like having it to be forced to be black borders, because
yes,
that's like, yeah. Then if you want to avoid burning, what you got to do is you got to go to your Wii settings and change it to 4:3.
Yeah, which stretches out the game.
Yeah. So I mean, it's the kind of thing that's really annoying for plasma owners. I mean, I've got an LCD, so like Mega Man 9, Contra Rebirth, all these games that are like that, it doesn't really bother me. But
I still think even if you're going for NES graphics, there's no excuse for not including widescreen support.
Yeah. Well,
because it's not that much harder. It really isn't.
Yeah. I guess they just wanted to make it feel like the NES game, even though the graphics are 2.5D. They sort of look like the GameCube remake of Adventure Island, if anybody checked that out.
No, I have Bonk for GameCube, but I never did play Adventure Island.
Yeah, well,
They were sort of released at the same time in Japan.
Yeah, also the game is easier because unlike the older games where it's a one-hit kill, whenever you get hit, it just lowers a couple of bars on your stamina meter. And the game's balance is thrown out the window once you start upgrading Master Higgins, and the upgrades are required if you want to collect all the gold melons in each level for the completionist people.
It sounds very Yoshi's Story, collecting golden melons. Isn't that what you did in Yoshi's Story?
Well, you collected fruit to finish the level, and you could collect all melons, which made your score astronomical. Like, that was okay.
Yeah. Also, another thing I didn't like about the game are the weird-ass animations, like, especially Master Higgins' float jump, where he looks like he's swimming like a frog in the air for some reason.
Oh, really? Didn't the Power Rangers do that a lot when they were getting like blown up?
Yeah,
they used to sort of swim across the screen.
Yeah. Well, it was more in Power Rangers. It was meant to be sort of flailing, you know. It's not like they were actually trying to swim through the air.
But I can swim through the air.
It did look like that for sure.
Yeah, and it has some of the weird knockback animations ever. It's just so annoying because whenever you get hit midair, it's just so delayed and it causes me to fall in a pit and die.
Yeah, well, knockback can be like this. Yeah.
I hate knockback so much.
Hatsworth has got knockback, but it's not as fatal as like.
No, it's not too bad.
Yeah, it's just
because like he can kind of recover in midair and then do a wall jump and then save himself. So
yeah,
right.
It's quite seldom that it's like insta death, which it is with like Mega Man and you know, a lot of other stuff.
Yeah, that actually introduces me to another change that they did. In the older games, I believe they had mid-level checkpoints. Because they made the game so much easier, they got rid of those.
Really?
Yeah, so when you die, you basically start over from the beginning. And if you collected any gold melons, which are sometimes in precarious areas in the level, where you have to do careful time jumps, you have to collect them again, which is annoying. Yeah, like, the only one inclusion that I never understood about Adventure Island the beginning was the inclusion of online leaderboards. Like, I could never understand why you'd need leaderboards for a platformer, basically.
It's kind of weird.
Yeah, it's...
Unless it really is like Yoshi's Story, where the score is like a big thing. Because it was in Yoshi's Story, like this, you know, that seemed to be like the main point of the game, really.
Yeah, but I just never understood the appeal. Like, I'm not a big leaderboard person, even though I enjoy games like Geometry Wars. Like,
that's the only game where I give a shit is Geometry Wars.
Yeah, like I totally understand for those games, but for Adventure Island, nah, it's just a throwaway feature. And
yeah, I guess so.
I guess that wraps up my new business.
Okay. Well, Greg is up next. And to start off, he has...
Yeah, we got an Excite Strike update. Yeah, so the last couple of episodes are going, I'll mention various things. But this is week 6, and I'll remind everyone that...
He's getting really hungry.
The Smash Brothers one ended in week 8, so we're coming up on that pretty quickly.
Wouldn't that be fantastic if you actually managed to pass it and go through E3, and they don't even mention anything?
Well, they're not going to mention it at E3. They don't...
Yeah, obviously, yeah, E3 is not particularly pertinent to this issue, but what is pertinent in terms of coming up on the time horizon is usually in the next, you know, so over the next couple of weeks, once we get, you know, a little way into June, so it will be sometime just not long after E3, we would expect Nintendo of Europe to do the quarter 3 release schedule.
And they might even do it during E3.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. They may move a little bit quicker on that for at least some of the key titles, you know, because of all the stuff coming out of E3. But I mean, they may not mention it in that. But if it doesn't show up on up on the full list that comes out a little way after, it's time to get worried. Because yes. I mean, the people have asked, you know, Nintendo to comment about, you know, in Europe about, you know, are you planning to launch this game? And you know, they say, oh, we have no plans. But you know, I mean, if they haven't officially announced something yet, they wouldn't expect them necessarily to say anything different. But I guess the real concern is how well it's sold in North America for me, or how poorly it's sold is more appropriate way of putting it. Because, you know, when we did with the show a couple of weeks ago, we could only remark that it wasn't in the top 10 of the NPDs. What we learned soon after that is that it was a lot worse than that. And that, in fact, it sold, I believe, was it about 13,000 copies in 10 days?
Yeah. But Greg, don't you know that games with no advertising or marketing whatsoever that have never, ever been supported by the company that released them and that wasn't even announced more than 3 weeks before it came out always have legs?
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, God, I hope it has legs because...
I do too,
I think the concern, certainly, with like you said, with the sort of sudden announcement and the absence of hype, you wouldn't expect it to have a big opening. So no. if it's going to do anything, it may well be on a sort of word of mouth fueled sort of slow crawl. But
well, only 15,000 people bought it. There's not enough mouths to feed the word of mouth.
I suppose that is an issue. You've got to start somewhere.
That's the other problem is that it's been so quickly supplanted by Punch Out in terms of the hype machine and word of mouth. So all of a sudden, every, you know, and you're about to bring it up too, but every video game podcast for the past 2 weeks they spend 10 minutes talking about Punch Out,
yeah.
Which is great for Punch Out. Yeah. It's really bad for Excitebots because people have stopped playing it and stopped talking about it.
The point I was going to make about it really is that, you know, Excite Truck was launched in all territories, actually, even in Japan. Which there's no sign that Excitebots is going to Japan either, for the record. But I think what concerns me is what we've seen from the different branches of Nintendo is that they have paid attention to how things have sold in other territories. Kind of what we touched on last
week.
With Rhythm. Yeah, Disaster's the other side of the coin. Yeah, that did come out in Europe. And maybe if it had been a surprise. If it had been a surprise modest success, maybe they might have thought about pursuing it in the US. But it did bomb.
No.
And No, it hasn't come out in the US yet, has it? And that's no, my
I think
fear.
Fatal Frame 4 was pretty much a bomb in Japan as well.
Yeah, Fatal Frame and Fatal Frame and Disaster and Captain Rainbow are the sort of hall of shame of first party sort of.
Well, Captain Rainbow is another issue altogether.
Yeah, but I'm just talking about how many thousands of copies they sold in Japan.
Oh, yeah.
You mean how many hundreds? Yeah.
No, I think they did crack. I think they did crack four figures.
That's terrible.
The point being that just the situation in itself looks a little bit ropey, and then when you factor in these sales numbers, I'm a little concerned. The only thing I'll say is Europe likes driving and racing games, so I hope that is enough to see us through at some point.
Especially off-road.
It is concerning at this point that we might not actually get it at all, so the question becomes, do we set a week cap on the strike? Does it just go on forever?
No more food for Greg.
Yeah.
After week 10, you start filling up Molotovs.
I think we can ask them if somebody on our staff can fake an accent in E3, we'll be fine. I want to play it so bad. Just give it to me.
All right, well, I'm going to move on to Punch-Out. So, yeah, I got this middle of last week. Shipped a little early for me compared to the European release date. So, but it was one of the happy instances where it came out in the same week in Europe as it did in North America. So, bravo. And I really love it. I mean, I've spoken before about Punch-Out for me is a big deal because it's pretty much the first game I could ever remember playing and completing. I had it for Christmas with the NES in 1988. I was a little 4 year old at the time, and getting pummeled by Mr. Sandman made me who I am today, for better or worse. And this
definitely for better.
This is a wonderful, wonderful sort of revival of that. I mean, in many ways, it feels kind of like that first game kind of come to life in a lot, because all the characters, are sort of very much as they were in terms of the stereotypes and all that, which is it is so wonderful. They didn't kind of sanitize it or anything. But they're so much more lively now, I mean, because a lot of people say, I didn't know Glass Joe was French, whereas you will know he's French this time.
Yeah, I'm sure.
They ram it down your throat pretty well, or, Don Flamenco can't go 10 seconds without saying olé, or, anything. So really get the idea now, but with the graphics, the cell shading, the lovely animation, all that, the voice work, you really... It does feel like the first game come to life. In terms of the gameplay, the fundamentals are all the same. The first time around, some of the actual guys are the same, but about halfway through, it starts to change up more radically, and then you've got the title defense mode where they are very different, especially the early characters. I mean, they are so... Because they're such pushovers the first time, and then they're actually, really quite tricky the next time. So, I mean, you will probably lose to Glass Joe, which is uniquely sort of humbling.
I've lost to him in NES.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, mainly as a kid.
Yeah, I guess so. But I could beat Glass Joe with my feet.
Well, he's Glass Joe. I mean.
Exactly. All you have to do is just sort of tap the one button. You're pretty much there. But this is just really great for the nostalgia factor. There's no doubt about that. But the gameplay is still solid, and what they do with it is that the fundamentals are the same, but when you get to the more late stages, the actual boxes themselves and their routines are quite a lot more sophisticated than they were in the old one, I think. Because what they can do in this is that the sort of the tells, the telegraphs, can be a little more subtle. Because you've got the sound that you can use. The sound is quite important for listening for a specific kind of thing that will give away what it's going to do. And obviously the animation and all that can be a lot more sort of intricate. So you've got more, especially once you get to title defense, you'll have things like, well, if he sort of ducks to the right with his head down, it's going to be a sort of change-up punch. Whereas if he ducks the head with his right head up, he's going to hit you quick. These sorts of things, you just could, with crude 8-bit graphics would have been a lot more challenging. And the way that things tended to get more difficult in the original Punch-Out was just that, it's like the Tyson fight, right? For the first half of the...
Well, the timing would get more strict, right? I mean, you just have less time to dodge.
And then, the margin of error would be so small in the sense that, Tyson could just knock you down with one punch.
Yes.
That's not so much what's going on here, although I haven't got to the very last fighter of title defense, so maybe he's like that. But... You know, like, with this, the way it gets more difficult is the things just get more complicated. They'll have more attacks. They'll have different, you know, like I said, the different tells and stuff.
That's the way it should be.
Yeah, and I think it's a really, that's where it isn't, it hasn't really evolved the gameplay so much as it has just exploited it quite a lot better. And I think what's really helped with that is that they've changed the structure from the old ones. The old ones obviously had like an arcade style structure. So what you'd have to do is actually beat all the fighters in a circuit to get the next like password. So the point is, you could beat a couple of guys, and then you know you'd face the next guy, and if you lost to him, well then you got to fight the previous ones again to get back to that point. They've dispensed with that entirely. And, that makes it a lot more... I mean, I can deal with it, with the old ones, because I grew up with it. But I think it's an appropriate decision, given, A, you know, for the new audience, and B, because these are so much more intricate now that I think going from one to the other would be really difficult. You know, because they are so much more complicated, you're looking for more subtle things, like at the very high end, not so much in the first time around. You know, that it just wouldn't be appropriate. And the great thing that they've included as well is the practice mode, where basically you fight a hologram and you can't be hurt in this, but you can hurt them. So what you can do is see their entire routine without having to get pummeled to death, you know, 10 times in a row to see what it is they're doing. And so then once you've learned that, then you can go in for the real thing and already be able to compete and not just get, you know, absolutely devastated for a while you're just figuring out what the hell's going on. So these are very appropriate, you know, modifications they've made to make the game just, you know, in terms of its structure, really nice. And you know, with the title defense, all that, the content feels pretty ample, the exhibition challenges are there, they're cool. So I think it's been really well done. I mean, the only complaint I would have is it doesn't have classic controller support, because the D-pad's a little small on the Wii remote for me. I mean, I tried the motion controls, they seem to work, but you know, I think the NES style is more up my street, and just that bigger D-pad would be so nice, because every now and again, if you accidentally press, you know, up and across when you just mean to press up to block, well then you'll dodge when you wanted to block, and then you might end up getting hit, and you know, that can be a little bit annoying for someone who's got large thumbs like myself. But I mean, it's a pretty minor complaint. I think it's great.
Well, then you might just love that Nyko wand.
Yeah. Very nicely done.
And I think John has gotten punched out.
Eventually. He had some shenanigans with the retailer on that or something.
Right. Yeah, obviously he's busy this week. I would guess he hasn't had time to
punch
play
out.
Much.
Yeah.
That's his bachelor party. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's quite likely, actually.
He just damn you, Popinski, and just downs a huge shot of vodka.
He's taken down some vodka Dradinsky while he tries to fight.
Vodka Drunkinski, the original way.
Yeah. But, you know, after E3, after the honeymoon, hopefully he'll come back and tell us his story on that too. And Greg, you had...
Yeah, I had a quick note on one thing. So a few weeks ago I talked about Star Blade on the Japanese VC arcade, the Namco polygonal shooter. You know, I was playing it, I was enjoying it and all that. And then but last week I was on the internet just looking around on the NeoGAF, and I love it. I love it when it's referred to as that. And, there's someone was on there was saying, oh yeah, it was actually a thread about Space Harrier, but they said, oh yeah, but someone was asking, like, can you use pointer controls in Space Harrier? And I was like, and then someone else said, no, but they're in Starblade. I'm like, what? No, they're not. And then I tried it, and it's like, I just unplugged my classic controller. It's like, oh, wow, they are. There are pointer controls in a virtual console game. That was a shock. And it does benefit the gameplay quite a bit, because, you know, the whole game is basically just an on-rails shooter where you can't even control anything. So it's very much a shooting gallery game. And you know, it's just much smoother than using the analog stick or the classic controller. But I guess the main thing to say is just that it kind of opens the door for a lot of other stuff. So I know John, when I mentioned it too, it was, you know, pumped at Thor Operation Wolf. So, you know.
Duck Hunt.
Yeah, good point.
I mean, Duck Hunt doesn't have the original version doesn't have a cursor on the screen, which you would need for Wii pointing. But I think Operation Wolf did.
Yeah, well, a lot of these arcade ones did because, like, you know, like maybe they would. Yeah, I think Star Blade like didn't use a light gun in the arcade. It did actually use like a stick, but they've put point and controls in, which, you know, is great because it's a great option to have. And obviously for the games that really did depend on it, well, then it's even better if they could include those. So it's just a sort of a very, you know, it's not something we've seen before. We kind of talked that they do a little more with these arcade ones than we've seen in the past, especially Namco. They have these really nice kind of front ends and, you know, menus and things. So, and this is them again. So yeah, I just think it's nice to see, and hopefully we'll see more of it.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if we see more arcade games, period, in America. We haven't had a single one since
GDC. Yeah, the Space Harrier just came out in Europe tonight. So that's like the first one that's come out in Europe for a while. North America still doesn't have it, as far as I know.
Yeah, no, we don't. We only have the original four from the launch.
Criminy.
So moving on with new business, I have been playing Mad World for the past week. Not every day, obviously. It's not a lengthy game, but this is a game that I can only play for about 20 minutes before I just have to put it down and go do something else. It's fun in very short bursts, but it's extremely shallow. I mean, it is a beat 'em up in which the enemies don't fight back. It's almost a shooting gallery, except you're not shooting, you're punching. When these guys, they will run up to you, and then when they get within 2 feet of you, they just stand there.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like in these games where, you know, you never have multiple enemies attacking you at the same time. They just kind of wait and take their turn. But in Mad World, none of them fight you. They just all stand around and wait for you to pick them up and throw them onto a spike.
Don't you think, like, it seems like they kind of maybe missed something here? Like, because apparently the hard mode is, like, famously difficult, and they do actually attack you and all sorts of stuff. It just seems like they're begging for a bit of an intermediate step there between the two.
It goes from hard to retard. I'm sorry. Sorry, but it just, like, it's so easy that there's really nothing to it. Like the whole game feels like the only thing to the game is to experiment and find the different ways you can kill guys. But the weird thing is that, you know, considering that is essentially all there is to it, there aren't that many ways to kill guys. Like in a typical level, there are only four or five different things lying around that you can use, and a lot of them sort of fit into the same classes, so there might be three different things that you can pick up and shove through the guy's head like a spike.
Yeah.
But the only difference is the graphic. I mean, the animation is the same, the reactions are the same. You know, there'll be two or three things that you can pick up and sort of just crash over the guy's head, and then it stays around him. So, you know, the obvious one is like a tire. You know, you kind of ring these guys with tires. But then you can pick up a trash can and do exactly the same thing. And then another level, you can pick up a picture frame and you can do exactly the same thing. It's like there's not that much variety in the ways that you can deal with these guys. And the way that the game provides some variety and keeps the stages from all being the same is that it's all the stages are filled with these little mini games that pop up, and, you know, it's like the bloodbath challenges, or sometimes it's just a particular hazard that comes up, like a saw blade that pops out of the wall, and, you know, at some point, and then you can use that in addition to all this other stuff. But there really isn't that much variety to the game, the levels are just bizarre. I mean, supposedly it's set in a city, but the entire city is built like an amusement park. I don't know. It feels like the game almost literally just leads you from one diversion to another.
Yeah, it does that.
But the diversions aren't really that much different from each other. So, like, the only diversion that I find to be kind of interesting is the boss battle. And the boss battles can be frustrating. There are some major camera problems in the game, which don't really matter during the main levels because the enemies don't attack you.
Yeah.
But during the boss battles, you do have to use the lock-on, but the lock-on will get lost after they do certain moves, and even then, a lot of times it doesn't really show you where they are, especially if they go above you. It doesn't pan up to show you the boss. It just kind of points you in the general direction.
Yeah. That was a big problem. But how far did he get into the game?
Right now I'm in the third castle stage, and I'm up to rank 30-something. So I think that's at least halfway through the game. I'm not particularly compelled to continue playing it all the way through, even though there's at most an hour or two left in it, because I'm just bored with it, you know? I mean, I think it's worth checking out, and the visual style I do love for sure. I love the art style of it. I have to say the violence is kind of disappointing for me, and I don't know if it's just that I'm overexposed to gratuitous violence in, you know, modern culture and modern entertainment. I think it's more that because the world and the characters are so over the top and silly in the first place that you don't really buy the violence. I don't. Like, it doesn't really feel real to me, and so it's not really shocking when I impale a guy on a stick. Especially after the first time you do it, because after that, they all look the same. But there's something about it where, it is clearly one of the most violent games ever made, and yet I'm not really finding that I'm put off by that. I'm not really finding that it even grabs my attention. It's just par for the course. I mean, it's just the way the game is set up. Of course it's that violent, mm-hmm. you know? But I think for violence to be... in other words, the sort of violence for violence's sake. I don't know. But to me, in order for violence to stand out and have some kind of artistic purpose, there has to be a contrast. And in here, the only contrast in the game is the literal optical contrast between the blood and the black and white.
I guess the point with Mad World, my expectation would be that it's meant to work on the level of, like, oh, that's so outrageous. You know, that it's so ludicrous. But I guess the problem
right.
is
but
that...
But it stops shocking you after the first couple minutes. That's the thing. Like, it runs out of juice
the repetition means that is going to run dry quite quickly, because you may or may not find
no
a particular gag outrageous the first time, but you're definitely not going to find it outrageous the nth time.
Exactly.
Yeah, I sort of understand where you're getting at, considering how when I play Killer 7, No More Heroes, and other over-the-top violent games, and I guess you could get bored of it really fast after playing more than one type of game and that type of...
Killer 7 is a little bit of a different animal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad, Luke, that you mentioned No More Heroes, because I think there are a lot of similarities between that and Mad World. Yeah.
I agree.
I mean, it's a sort of a game about beating these people to increase your rank, and it's sort of centered around these boss fights where the guys in between are, you know, they don't really put up much of a fight. Mm. And it's over-the-top violence and gore, etc., but I feel like all of those things are handled better in No More Heroes, and I enjoyed playing that game a lot more. I mean, despite its obvious problems, I just enjoyed that a lot more than I am Mad World so far, and, you know, and...
The super-populated city of Santa Destroy.
Yeah.
Pretty
That's
soft.
That would be the biggest problem.
I've been in a city evacuated because of a hurricane that had more people on the streets than that.
You thought you were playing thought you were playing some sort of weird cell shaded 28 Days Later the first time.
It's very bizarre.
I would play that game. But yeah, Mad World's not a bad game, but I definitely I'm not all that impressed by it. Mm. Certainly not on the level of some of the reviews it got when it first came out. And you know, who knows? I'm playing it months later, so maybe it's just that the
hype,
you know, the general perception of it has has gotten to me at this point.
I think there are reviewers out there who are susceptible to the fact, ooh, it's bloody, therefore it's mature.
Yeah, I would actually find that I think the only way you could be consistently entertained by the violence and the gore in Mad World is if you're actually really, really immature.
But, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I actually find
you're
that the
sociopath.
Violence in No More Heroes, although, you know, not nearly as over the top as in Mad World, I found that the violence and the combat in No More Heroes was actually a lot more satisfying, a lot more visceral feeling, and even by the end of the game, when I would do these challenges just to build up experience or money or whatever, where you're killing like 100 guys in 3 minutes, I actually felt like when I kill those guys, it felt like I had did something, you know, like I just killed that guy. And in Mad World, it feels like I'm throwing puppets at spikes. It just doesn't carry through the same
it's
way.
Like crash
it's really
test
hard
dummies.
To describe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard to explain, but yeah, it really is kind of like you're tossing
blood-filled,
you know,
crash
Kool-Aid-filled crash test dummies. They're just like piñatas to just have your way with them.
Just brutalize these things. Don't worry about what they are.
Yeah, actually, maybe that's a good way to put it. Mad World's like a piñata game. So really quickly, I finished today GTA Chinatown Wars, and the only thing I wanted to say about it is that as you get towards the end of the mission arc, the variety of the missions actually ends up being really good. Like, you have a lot of missions where you're flying a boat or you're dropping grenades out of a helicopter.
It's titty titty bang bang.
That's a car. But, part two. You know, you're driving a boat, shooting missiles at people. Some pretty interesting missions come up. They're actually better mission variety than in the console games, I would say. But unfortunately, the last two missions of the game, which you can do in any order, or I guess the last three, they end up kind of falling prey to the same problem as all the other GTA final missions, in that the very end of the game is you going into a building and shooting up 100 dudes, which is definitely not the strong suit of the gameplay. I just wanted to comment on that because I think it's kind of disappointing that, you know, it seemed like they were taking some really cool steps forward and getting away from some of these repetitive combat heavy missions that are in the console games, and then unfortunately it ends on a pretty familiar note, and it's frustrating too because the mechanics aren't that good. You know, it relies heavily on the lock-on, which is pretty bad.
Thank you. I hate the lock-on.
It's been bad in all the GTAs, and it's bad in this one, you know.
Did it really surprise you that one of the characters ended up being a cross-dresser?
No. That also happens in every GTA.
Yeah, but I think it was handled more comedically.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, because
it was.
Because it was a really ugly cross-dresser.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. The art for that little cutscene actually did make me laugh. Anyway, that's Chinatown Wars. I'm probably pretty much done with that. EA Sports Active, I'm not really going to talk about today unless you guys want to, but I've been doing a daily blog about it, so I've written a lot about it. I've still got more to write about it as we go up to E3, and actually by the time you hear this, I should be finished with that arc of playing it. I'm sure I'll play it more after I get back from the expo, but I'm not taking it with me. But I think it's a good program. It's been effective so far. And the last thing I've been playing is Majora's Mask, and I'm reticent to really get into this because I could talk about this game for an hour and I don't want to do that. Maybe certain comments I have about it I'll reserve until the next segment when we do Zelda 2, because I think there's some very interesting parallels between Majora's Mask and Zelda 2.
Are you enjoying seeing it in the higher res? Does it look, you know, because... Yeah, it's kind of is more detailed, like the textures were somewhat better than say Ocarina, but it kind of all gets lost in that low res N64 environment. But does the virtual console presentation, you know, bring it out anymore?
Well, I haven't played Ocarina in a long time, so it's hard for, I don't have it on virtual console, so right. I can't really make a detailed comparison there. I mean, it looks good, so, you know, there are certain 3D models in the game that you'll look at, you'll be like, oh my god, N64.
Yeah,
it's just, you know. But for the most part, I think the game's graphical style and presentation holds up really well, and I think Majora's Mask has aged better than Ocarina because it uses all these sort of camera tricks and lighting effects, and just the visual mood of the game is so distinct that I think those elements sort of stand outside the ever decaying graphical fidelity. So I think, you know, it's easy to be impressed by, I mean, little dinky tricks, like as the final seconds tick by in one of the 3 days, the screen will basically like become smaller. So everything gets compressed that's right. There's a black square border around the entire display, and, you know, it'll go home. It's this really foreboding sound effect, and then a couple seconds later it'll do it again, and it'll get even smaller until right before the rooster crows or the moon crashes, you're playing on about 50% of the screen, so you can barely even read the numbers on the screen. And, you know, it's totally like a embellishment on the game, but it's so cool. And it hasn't aged at all. Like, it's still cool. It's just as cool as it was 9 years ago. So those little kinds of things, I think, make the game stand up really well in terms of presentation. But overall, I just kind of wanted to say that I still really, really love Majora's Mask. I always loved it from the day it came out. And it holds up great And I understand that there are people who don't like it. I was hearing on Retronauts, you know, Scott Sharkey was saying he's tried it many times and can never get into it. And I have a feeling that he probably never got more than a couple hours into it, because I think the first 3-day sequence is kind of poorly done. It's a very arcane sequence of events that you have to go through within the town.
It's the least, like, because it's totally not open-ended at all. It's totally
very, sort of, very linear.
It's scripted,
and
yeah. Whereas obviously, the whole 3-day element introduces a sort of scripted element to the whole game. That's kind of the point. But you still have quite a lot of freedom within that to do. So it's not as restrictive as A, the concept kind of makes it sound, or B, those first opening period of the game can make it sound. So I think you could be right about that. It's definitely something you need to keep going with, to kind of appreciate exactly what it's doing.
The reason I bring it up is that I feel like more people should give this game a chance. And I just want to say to listeners that if you're one of the people who has tried Majora's Mask and just never got very far into it, really, you know, didn't like it at first blush and never went back to it, my suggestion is, honestly, load up Game Facts and use that to get you through the first 3 days until you get the Ocarina. And once you have the Ocarina, now you control the flow of the game. You have, you have the freedom to do basically whatever you want. You can do as little or as much as you want in each 3-day period. You can slow down time. You can skip ahead 12 hours at a time. So that's when the game opens up, and that's when it, you know, and once you go through a couple periods where you're kind of doing what you want, you can spend, sort of like Pikmin, you can spend a whole 3 days just earning money and sticking it in the bank, or you can go out and do this random assortment of little small tasks that kind of add up. You know, you can go get a couple masks, you can help a couple people in town, you can go play half a dungeon and go get the new arrows, and then come back and then go back the next time and beat the boss, you know, blaze through there and go grab the boss. You have so much freedom at that point that I think it'll grab you pretty quickly. But the first 3 days, you know, in other words, the first hour and a half of the game, there's some problems with it. And I would say do whatever you have to do to get over that hump, and it will grow on you very, very quickly after that.
Yeah, I actually was one of the people that didn't like Majora's Mask, but that was partially because my first experience with Majora's Mask was the bad GameCube version, where it constantly crashed on me, and I was just so frustrated, I was just like, fuck it.
There was some really terrible emulation on the GameCube compilation disc for Zelda.
Yeah, I went up to Snowpeak, and that's where it started crashing on me, and I just couldn't take it anymore. But I really understand the first hour. Surprisingly, it didn't really hurt. It didn't really affect me that much. I thought it was pretty easy, but I can understand the frustration since the game pushes you to get that part done, or it's just try it all over again.
The problem is there's like a series of 3 or 4 specific things you need to do in the first 3 days in order to be able to proceed. And the game really doesn't do a good job of telling you where to start or even what to do next after you do the first one. And you're in this pretty large town with all these people walking around, and it's very easy to just kind of roam around and desperately ask, you know, talking to people over and over, trying to figure out what you're supposed to do. And it's not easy necessarily to stumble upon what you need to do and in what order. So that's my issue with it, I guess.
Yeah, same.
It's very un-Nintendo-like, the first 3 days. Anyway, I don't know, maybe some of you guys will be jumping into Majora's Mask as time goes on.
I probably won't, because the Japanese versus Japanese, the Europe's bulk pal, so no. Sorry. I would like to, but it's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's the end of new business. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back to do retroactive number 6, Zelda 2. We'll be right back. everyone. We are back with segment 2 and retroactive number 6. You voted for Zelda 2. Actually, you also voted for Star Tropics, but James broke the tie.
Thank you, James.
Fuck yeah.
We've been playing Zelda 2 Adventure of Link, and I hope you have as well. Before we jump into some of the comments that were left in the forums, I think some really interesting reactions to this game, and it's only a sampling this week. We will come back later with more of those. But to give an introduction to the game, I kind of wanted to see if the four of us here, what our experience levels are with this game. Have any of you not played it?
I had not touched it prior to this.
And James?
I had played it a little bit for the sake of historical
curiosity. Yeah.
So this is essentially your first time
playing it in a meaningful sense.
Mm. Okay. And Luke?
I played it when the GameCube compilation disc came out.
Okay. Me too. I was exposed to it as a kid. I had friends who owned it, and so I watched them, and I would, you know, pick it up for a few minutes here and there. But and actually, I remember renting it once. I could not have been more than 6 years old, and I was flummoxed. I mean, I never even got the hammer. I never even got that far. I was just, it was way over my head.
Well, that doesn't surprise me from what I've
played. Yeah, exactly. So, I did play probably halfway through the game when the compilation disc came out, because that was the first time I ever owned it, so to speak. And then this time I've gotten even farther, but I won't get into that because I'm probably farther than you guys are.
Yeah, I would have thought so.
So, Luke, I guess, I have on here in the notes, is it different than you remembered? But it wasn't that long ago that you played it for the first time, so I guess it couldn't be that much different than your initial recollection of it.
Yeah, not really.
But I guess a more interesting question for the other two is this what you expected, or is it different?
Well, it is very much what I expected, because I didn't know a lot about the game.
Yeah,
you can't help but you're a big Zelda fan, even though I never played it. You absorb by osmosis, and you know, sometimes just deliberately wanted to read about what it was like. Mm-hmm. So it is what I was expecting. It is, you know, sort of a Simon's Quest-y in some ways, as I was expecting. especially the very curt dialogue.
Yes. Sometimes curt to a fault.
Yeah, well,
it's actually the precursor to Twitter.
Oh, yeah, boy. Yeah,
the tweeting in Mido or whatever, you know. I mean, it's, so that's an issue. You know, obviously that was an issue with Simon's Quest. But that's the thing. I probably would have enjoyed this as a child because I enjoyed Simon's Quest, and I don't think it's as bizarre
that's true.
As that is, to be honest, or as sort of unfair in some ways in the level design of things. But so it is what I was expecting, no doubt about that. I try not to think of it too much as you know, is this gonna give me, you know, what I want from Zelda or whatever, because, you know, just try to take it on its own merits, really. And I've kind of enjoyed it in some ways. It's a weird mix. It's kind of interesting to see how it all kind of hangs together. Because it does have this kind of RPG, you know, more explicitly RPG kind of element with the experience points and everything and the levels that, you know, Zelda's haven't had, even though sometimes they're referred to alongside RPGs, which, you know, you generally think is inappropriate. But in this case, you know, it kind of is. And obviously, you know, it kind of reminds you a bit of the latter-day Castlevania games as well.
I think I didn't pull it out of the forums, but TYP mentioned that this was kind of his first exposure to a so-called RPG or elements of an RPG. And actually, I think that's probably very, very common of children of that era, not only because it was an early NES game, but honestly, it was an early Japanese RPG. I mean, the RPG genre wasn't particularly well established previous to Zelda 2. So, you know, at the time, Nintendo might not have even thought of this as being a hybrid. I doubt that it was that intentional that they were creating this kind of bizarre cross-genre thing, because the genres themselves weren't really established at that point.
Yeah, it wasn't such an archetype to kind of play with,
But the other thing is, sometimes you hear people describe the Zelda series as an action RPG series, and Zelda 2 is almost literally
Zelda
RPG.
2 is that. Yeah. I think it's entirely appropriate. Elsewhere, I'm not so convinced that that's as appropriate, personally, but Yeah, I mean, so it was that part of it, you know, was still interesting to see in terms of the for me, what I didn't know as much about was the leveling, you know, exactly how that works with the experience points and the lives and the continues and exactly the significance of those, in the sense that you restart at the palace with Sleeping Zelda every time. But if you've got major items, or you know you've done certain things, they will carry over. But your experience.
See, this is where I wanted to bring in Majora's Mask.
Yeah, because of course Majora's Mask, when you return to the dawn of the first day, you lose your rupees, you lose all this other stuff. But you know, if you defeated a boss, or you got a mask, or you know, all that stuff kind of carries over. So yeah, there is a real similarity there.
I especially notice it because I'm playing both at the same time. sometimes literally back to back, I go from one.
Well,
to the other.
I guess Lucas, you played both at the same time ish on the compilation disc, sort of, or reasonably close together.
Well, yeah, and I bought Majora's Mask on the Virtual Console because I wanted a more stable version.
Yeah, oh, sure, absolutely.
Good decision.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in a way, I can see the similarities, but in Majora's Mask, they had to implement it that way. Otherwise, you would have to repeat the same bosses and get the same treasures. As rupees, arrows, and bombs, they're really disposable, and you can get them anywhere.
And you can deposit, Johnny mentioned, you know, you can deposit rupees in the bank and, you know, just withdraw them out. So it's not a particularly big deal. But with this, the biggest thing is the experience points. So you accumulate experience points, but if you run out of lives, then those experience points you're essentially lost, aren't they? You know, so that's where there's a kind of tension in staying alive. You know, if you're close to leveling up and therefore you can enhance one of the three stats, you know, you've got your attack, your magic, and your health, then those are valuable upgrades to have. And you know, if you are so close and then you know you get hit and you die and you lose everything, that's it's an unusual kind of tension to have in a Zelda game.
Yeah, it is, and I think it can occasionally really bite you in the ass and be you know, piss you off. But in general, I think it's actually a good thing because it raises the stakes of the game. It makes you want to get through this temple without dying. And that's not something that you're really familiar with. I mean, even in Majora's Mask, for instance, if you die in a temple, it just puts you back at the beginning. You haven't lost anything.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not even time, really. But like, if you think about it, without the loss of experience, and I guess, well, there aren't rupees in Zelda 2, are there? So just the experience. But if you take away that, if you make it so that you never lose your experience, the whole process of dumping you back in the temple and making you get back to where you were, it ends up being a too human kind of thing where it's really just annoyance for the sake of penalizing you, right? Like, you haven't really lost anything. You just have to go through this shit to get back to where you were, right? Or in Too Human, you have to watch this awful cutscene over and over
God.
that lasts a really long time.
Don't remind me of Too Human, please.
Please skip. Please,
so
I beg you.
You know, I think Zelda 2, it raises the stakes and it sort of avoids that kind of annoying thing in that death, there is a consequence to death, and it makes you think about it. It makes you play more conservatively.
Definitely.
And also it tends to break the game up into these episodes, very Majora's Mask-like, in that, you know, you feel like you go out, you go to a hard temple, you die, and you go back to the beginning, and it's like, well, you know, I died, but at least I got that heart container on the way, or at least I got a level up before I lost all my life. So it always feels like you're making significant progress, and even though you have to go back and do some of the stuff in the temple over again.
Well, as long as you did that. If, on the other hand, you just miss out on that thing, then you got to do it again.
But I try to pace my gaming sessions with Zelda 2 so that I'm pretty assured that I will accomplish something that will stick with it, you know, before I die. And it's okay if I die as long as I did a couple important things that will not reset.
Sure, yeah.
James, I haven't heard a whole lot from you yet on this, so
I'm kind of in agreement with pretty much everything that's been said up to this point. It doesn't really affect me because I haven't really felt particularly threatened as I've played through the game. I haven't gotten that far.
You will. You will.
Yeah, I understand that. I haven't gotten but so far that it's been an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't really suffered the wrath of the game, as it were.
That's good. I'm surprised, actually. I think it says something about your skills as a gamer, because I think Zelda 2 is consistently challenging throughout.
It's challenging, but I've managed the challenge, as it
but
were.
I think the main thing, you know, the obviously with the challenge, you got the combat now. The combat, I think, again, this would have been something that would have appealed to me as a younger gamer, you know, the idea that there's kind of more active combat than you get in a lot of games in terms of, you know, the blocking and, you know, like hitting certain points of the enemy and stuff. You know, it's kind of fairly sophisticated for 8-bit stuff.
It's probably the most complex combat in the entire series, even though through the modern games.
Yeah.
Like, say, for instance, the boomerang guys. Yeah, it's kind of cool where you'll be fighting one, you might sort of crouch down, get in close, and be, you know, stabbing him, but he could throw ones over your head, so at some point you'll have to sort of time when you kind of stand up and turn back and then block the one that's coming at your back and then go back to stabbing him again. Yeah, this is sort of interesting sort of rhythm and interplay that you get, which, you know, again, I think at the time would have seemed really quite cool. I guess my only complaint about it now would be that his sword is so damn short. I think the
range is pathetic.
I have an idea about why that is. I think it probably has to do with the sprite bounding box.
I'm sure there was probably a technical element to it, because I think what the problem is that when you reduce the range down to that kind of size, it makes judging everything that little bit more difficult, you know, because you're kind of working on a smaller scale in terms of, right, so, you know, is this guy going to hit me if we're standing this close, and am I going to hit him if I'm going to stand this close? You know, everything's so talked together that actually distinguishing those crucial distinctions is more difficult than it perhaps could be if, for instance, you know, you was doing it on the 16-bit systems and you wouldn't have had any of those issues about the way you drew the sprite.
It's interesting to hear you say that you probably would have been attracted to the combat as a child, whereas maybe you have this beef with it now. I have had completely the opposite effect, where as a kid, playing it the little bit that I did and watching people play it, the combat was very intimidating to me.
Really?
I think that was the challenging part of the game. And I would, when I did play it as a kid, I would really try hard to avoid enemies on the overworld screen. I would go to great ends to never get in random battles if I didn't absolutely have to. And I just really dreaded going into the temple because it's like all combat, right?
Sure.
I like the exploration parts. Right. Now, as an adult, I go back to it, and the combat is by far my favorite thing in the game. And I think it's that I feel it's so skill-based. I mean, it is very challenging, and the timing tolerances are very small. And what I like about it is that not only does Link, in an RPG fashion, get more powerful as you play through the game, but I feel like I get better at the game the more I play at it. And
I can see
very clearly the differences.
Definitely. There's a learning curve to fight. You know, you get these different kinds of enemies that have different routines. It kind of amused me that one of them was basically a Hammer Brother.
Yeah.
That amusing.
Absolutely.
You know, so, yeah, but that part of it, I think, when I say I really would have been attracted to it as a kid, I think it still works now. I just think it would work even quite a lot better if, you know, the range was different. You know, like, you know, the enemies had bigger range, you had bigger range. It was just all on a bigger scale, so it was all a bit more distinguishable. You know, and you could probably, you know, if you have better graphics and stuff, sort of like with what I was talking about Punch-Out, you know, you could make it a little more sophisticated just because you can do these little extra things. So it's a little constrained, but within the constraints, I think they did a pretty good job with that. The main concern that I have about the game, I haven't played it to the extent I have so far, Johnny, I haven't played more of it, perhaps you could fill me in, is variety in the level design of the side-scrolling parts. You know, so far seems kind of nondescript, and there hasn't been too much. How much does that develop as the game goes on?
The graphics will not develop very much. But
what is this variety of which you speak?
The level design, I think, it won't take great strides, but there will be little variations, and especially in some of the new enemy types that come into play and the way that those are combined. I mean, sometimes there'll be two different kinds of enemies on the screen when you're in the temple, and the combination of those is considerably different to approach than if you were getting them one at a time.
Right.
And then also how that plays into the level design. I mean, there are certain enemies that you do not want to meet on a crumbling bridge.
Oh, God.
And,
yeah, I agree.
And there are multiple kinds of encounters like that that come up. And so I think the level design, I don't think it disappoints as you get later on. The level designs in the later temples are significantly more difficult than the ones.
But it's mostly
ones.
Sort of enemy based. Do you think like the enemies in certain locations rather than like, you know, the layouts being really complicated or, you know, something like that?
That's part of it, but the layouts change as well, right. And not as much, maybe.
Okay, right.
But it's both. Okay. I would say.
Oh, that's interesting because it's a different kind of sort of dynamic where you've got this situation where you've got side scrolling, you know, it's a little bit like a little bit like a Castlevania, obviously, and stuff like that. One of the things I felt about Simon's Quest that was sort of, you know, the because it was more open ended, there was more exploration, that the level design got very watered down. Yeah, and from what the other Castlevanias were, and that's where the game was a bit weak. Because when you're trying to create a big sort of, you know, explorative game like this, but then you have these side scrolling sections, it's quite a tricky thing to get where to somehow make those bits feel, you know, sort of on a par with games that have like levels that are, that's the whole game, you know, and it's very strictly designed and it's very tight. Compared to this kind of more open-ended thing. But you think it manages it over the course of the whole game.
Yeah, there are temples with memorable level designs, I'll put it that
way.
That's distinctive,
good.
Elements of level
design.
Well,
that might be good or that might not be good.
Memorable for a reason.
some of them are memorable for...
some are famous and some are infamous, as it were.
Yeah. But anyway, I guess we now that we've gotten some of the general stuff out of the way, we should get into some of the forum posts, and some of these may lead us into further discussion. But Drew MG posted that, I've always been partial to this game, if only because I feel like it gets an unfair amount of criticism from people who don't feel it's a real Zelda game. I think if this game didn't have the word Zelda on the front of the box, it would be remembered fondly as an NES gem, not a black sheep.
Well, it's an interesting thing. It's a bit of a... It goes both ways, doesn't it? In the sense that, well, you know, how many people would have played it if it wasn't called Zelda, you know, as opposed to the first thing. I mean, it depends
if
what...
If it's just called Link's Quest.
It depends
whatever.
What other thing it would have had on the box, I suppose. You know, I mean, it could have... not have Zelda, but it could have had something else. But, you know, I think that for me, in terms of this whole thing, it was a real Zelda game. Well, I don't really think that's very material to my enjoyment of the game. I mean, the one thing I will say is I could see how some people might kind of be not that sort of, if you are looking for certain aspects of Zelda, primarily for me the cerebral aspect of Zelda with the puzzle solving, the item use, that kind of aspect, it's not there.
No, that's not in Zelda.
You've got
2.
The action, you know, and the combat is obviously very different. You've still got the kind of adventuring elements to like the fetch quests kind of things that you get, you know, like you've got to get the trophy to give to this woman so then she'll show you into a basement where a uncle or whatever will teach you a magic spell, and you got to find some guy out in a hut in the forest that'll let you cross the bridge, and you know, these sort of tenuously linked things you do get in subsequent Zelda games. You get these trading sequences and things like that, so it's got that in it, but the puzzles and all that you might associate with it doesn't, so I kind of get that, but I think it's important to take it on its own merits ultimately.
Yeah, it sort of reminds me how Super Mario Bros. 2 isn't really Super Mario Bros. 2 in Japan.
Well, it doesn't, because this really is Zelda.
Yeah,
I mean,
there is a difference in the sense that Mario 2 was designed
as
an unrelated...
They ham-fisted in a franchise that would work in the US.
Whereas this was conceived as a sequel to Zelda, but just as a very different one, as a departure.
Well, can it really be a departure after one game?
I mean, think about the difference between Zelda 1 and Zelda 2 and Mario 1 and the real Mario 2. It is a departure.
In that sense,
you know?
It's a departure,
In other words, Lost Levels was almost an expansion pack, and with Zelda 2...
The graphics are totally different, the perspective's different, the gameplay's...
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely a very significant departure, but I guess the point is you wouldn't necessarily have the sort of entrenched expectations that we do now.
Exactly.
What was a, quote, Zelda game at the time? I mean...
Well, it was The Legend of Zelda. It was the first game. That's all we had to go on. Yeah. But, I mean, I still think it's bold of Nintendo to try something that is so clearly very, very different. I mean, because, you know, the first Zelda, it was an extremely popular game in its
own time. On the very basic level of, in screenshots, which obviously, or, you know, on the back of the box or whatever, back in those days it was pretty important. It just looks different. You know, it's side on. You know, that immediately people are going to say, well, you know, that looks completely different from the first Zelda. You know, so in a very basic, fundamental way, it gave off a totally different sort of vibe. So, I mean, in that sense, it's a very interesting decision. And, you know, quite unlike just about anything I can think of Nintendo doing, because with
nowadays,
because even Doki Doki Panic is far more fundamentally similar to the first Mario than Zelda 2 is to Zelda 1.
It's just it's a good point. Just with the addition of turnips, effectively.
And of course, it was actually made by some of the people that made the original Super Mario Brothers, whereas the Lost Levels game wasn't. That was kind of delegated away as a sort of quick
grab. Oh, I didn't know that.
No, apparently that is the case. Yeah,
so they're told make something quick.
Just make more levels. And...
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. Well, we have a good forum post that correlates with this very topic. Mop It Up posted, Zelda 2 is an example of why companies are afraid to experiment with a beloved franchise, and this was released back before Zelda even was an established franchise. Had this game not existed, something tells me Zelda 3 would have been quite a different game. At the end of the day, the worst Zelda game is still better than 80% of all other games.
Is he referring to the CDI Zelda games?
No.
Those don't count. referring to Zelda 2, which presumably, a lot of people say is presumably the worst Zelda game. I'm not necessarily agreeing with that. I understand that a lot of people would say that. You know, all Mop It Up is claiming is that even if you think this is not the best Zelda game, it's still better than most other stuff. And that kind of goes back to the Drew MG's post that I already read about, you know, if it didn't have Zelda on the front of the box, it would still be considered one of the gems of NES, and
I think we could agree it certainly wouldn't sort of offend people as it seems to do to some people
exactly.
in the same way.
Exactly.
I mean, but you know, whether it would be more or less appreciated is something that's kind of difficult to know.
Yeah, but you know, I posted it in the thread to some controversy, but I said, you know, I think regardless of where you think this sits within the pantheon of Zelda, I said I think it's one of the best NES action games that I've played. And again, that's a conclusion that I arrived at just in the past couple of days, because, you know, again, growing up, the action part of it was my least favorite.
Mm.
That was the part that scared me and put me off from it. Going back to it now and getting more comfortable with the combat and starting to enjoy some of the intricacies and the difficult to grasp nuances of playing the action part of the game, I'm starting to really appreciate that, and I think, you know, this is better than most NES action games. Like, there's a lot to this, and it's quite complex also for
an NES.
It's
different from
a
lot of those, you know. I mean, obviously, you got your Mega Mans, your Castlevanias, your run and guns, like your Russian Attack and Contra and all that, but, you know, this is totally different from any of those.
Yeah, I mean, because there's a lot of twitch to it, you know, maybe primarily coming from the shortness of the sword and the very proximity, there's a lot of twitch element to it, but there's a lot of depth too. You have to know how to approach enemies in different ways.
The other thing I think is interesting about it is the fact that, you know, there's still some of that, you know, you learn techniques and so, you know, use some of the, which has kind of come back in subsequent Zelda games, of learning sword techniques. You know, I think, which is kind of, again, for that day and age especially, is, you know, obviously you had Metroid and the way that did things, but that was, you know, sort of more about traversing the environment a lot. I mean, you did get better weapons, obviously, but, you know, with this it was more just new ways to fight, and that was, you know, a big part of the game. So I don't think a lot of the time, you know, when you're talking about Mega Man or this, Castlevania even, you wouldn't necessarily talk about it, you know, combat. You wouldn't talk about, you know, that term necessarily to just like shooting a bunch of stuff. Whereas, you know, that is a very pertinent term in this case, because that's what it is
combat.
It's
not fighting.
Combat more like as we think of it in modern games.
Well, yeah. Combat more as if we think of it just in the term of the word combat.
Yeah, it's the literal sense as well, you know. But yeah. It's a gameplay terms in the sense that there's this kind of back and forth between you and the enemies that, you know, most of the time, you know, you standard enemies in a lot of action games on the NES, there is no back and forth. You either kill them or they get you, and that's that. You know, you either...
Yeah, that's... Yeah. That's interesting that there is almost as much defense as there is offense in Zelda 2. Mm. I mean, you really have to learn to use the shield a lot. You will die if you don't block things with the shield.
Yeah.
And especially with, like, fighting the Iron Knuckles, I mean, the fascinating thing there is that they have shields too. And yeah. So you get into this weird little dance where you're trying to, you know, pay very, very close attention to where their sword's coming and sort of anticipate their movements. And then eventually you start to find these weird little ways you can attack them that they can't defend against so well. Like you can sort of slide into them with a crouching stab, or you can jump at them and sort of try to hit them in the head at exactly the right moment. And it's very hard for them to shield that.
There's one thing that I noticed about this that plays very differently from a lot of action games on the NES is how slidey Link is, how much momentum he has.
He's more like Luigi in Lost Levels.
Yeah, I mean, he is, you know, like, I mean, there's some parts where it's very much plays on that, like the sequences where you'll be on a bridge and you'll get those, like, fish heads that spit fire, and you kind of have to crouch while sliding, so slide under them and block their fireball and then stand up again and get running. And yeah, for something that is quite combat based, it's quite weird to have him control like you said, like a Luigi character in a platform game. There's not a lot of platforming in it, but
you can totally use it to your advantage.
Yes, you can. Yeah, well, the example just there, for instance.
Oh, and the Stalfos, I mean, if you know how to slide stab, you will never get hit by a Stalfos.
Oh, I hate Stalfos in the game.
They can't block low, so you just slide in there, easy as pie.
One thing that I thought was interesting was how this Legend of Zelda has a bigger emphasis on magic when compared to items. Like, the items in Legend of Zelda 2 are more passive.
Yeah, that's true. So the items like the hammer or the candle or that, they're kind of like global kind of items, you know, whereas the magic is the discretionary part.
Right. There were some passive items in the first Zelda 2. I mean, the ladder, you know, you only use it in a couple places, really. There's a raft, too, that's almost useless.
Yeah, but more. So. But magic is more predominant when compared to items.
Yeah, well, in terms of gameplay, in terms of, like, you know, okay, so I need to decide. There was a bit of a resource management thing going on, you know, with deciding like whether you want to use the shield spell or the life spell, or, you know, maybe use jump so you can sort of get to a higher place and then skip some enemies down there. But then, you know, if you use it then you've got less magic to use down the road. Things like, you know, so yeah, that's probably the most sort of intricate part of the gameplay that's not about combat.
It's one of the most obvious elements that was carried over directly into Zelda 3 and pretty much all subsequent Zeldas, is that you can use magic. And, you know, in Zelda, in the later games, magic became more tied to the items. So there were certain items that you could only use by spending some magic, or maybe you could do something extra with them if you chose to use some of your magic power. It wasn't like you're casting spells. I mean, there are the three spells in Zelda 3. They're the three spells in Ocarina of Time, but they're not used that often.
No, they're kind of certainly not essential for a start.
And no.
And not particularly useful in general.
Yeah, but you will use almost all the spells in Zelda 2 a lot, and you pretty much have to. Yeah, I think it's interesting, and again, it's a level of sophistication that's above most NES games, you know, when you get to that level, especially action games. Just, you know, the only thing I can compare it to is, like, Totally Rad. or Battle of Olympus, which is very clearly an imitation of Zelda 2. And, you know, arguably an improved imitation. But, you know, that's the template, for sure, for Battle of Olympus. Great game. Man, I would love to play that again. So, speaking of some of the melting together of different elements here, TYP posted in the forums, Zelda 2 is a curious hybrid of genres. People ridicule Zelda 2 for being different from the other games in the series, but saying that is rather unfair. It introduced a lot of gameplay mechanics and ideas reprised in later games, such as more elaborate sword play, you even learn new moves, towns with people you must interact with, and crude trading sequences.
These are all things that have been reprised, especially I think from Ocarina onwards, you know, I mean, the sword technique stuff was kind of particularly strong in Twilight Princess, wasn't it? You
had
quite a lot of that.
And there was some of it in the counter mechanisms in Wind Waker.
The parry and
the more active battle element. And in fact, that's kind of similar to Zelda 2 in a way, isn't there? The more timing based fighting.
It was pretty generous. I always felt
very scripted.
It was very easy, but it was
cool.
The same kind of effect.
Well, I think a better example of Wind Waker being inspired by Zelda 2 is that there are enemies that you can only really attack from behind.
Like once you get you have to kind of attack them at a certain weak spot, and then they're vulnerable all over after that, or something like that. Just the idea of that kind of more specific kind of, not the indiscriminate kind of hack and slash that
where you deal the massive damage.
Certain amount, certain amount of Zelda, combat in like Link to the Past, very often was like a pretty indiscriminate, slashing.
Just
kind of
hammer
thing,
the button.
And you kind of started to get beyond that a bit when you get to Ocarina and you're fighting the Stealthos because they have a shield, So
right, and those were cool, but the rest of the battles were pretty much hit the button.
Yeah, most of them were.
Yeah.
I would say in Wind Waker there was a lot more of the engagement type fighting.
And also Twilight Princess, some of those fights, like remember the guys with the winged lizards that had the shields that you could hookshot onto and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They have been getting, with the 3D ones, they've been kind of almost getting closer to Zelda 2's kind of
they've been moving each one. I would say they add a layer of abstraction to the combat. But you could also say that with the removal of the parry system, it took a little bit away in Twilight Princess.
It's interesting if we end up moving to a Motion Plus.
That's where I was going with
for the next Zelda.
Is that the next game is Motion Plus combat? If that's the case, then it would be sort of the next logical
full circle.
Step.
Come full circle.
I guess one of the more ways you can look at it is kind of a logical progression for the original Zelda. It's just like, well, if it's a fantasy game and it's, sort of swords and sorcery and stuff, Zelda 2 is more in line with that general, the general kind of fantasy idea. Like, there is sword play and magic, and, in that sense, it's kind of more appropriate for the fantasy setting than the original was.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It kind of like fits that theme better. But obviously, they in the end decided that what Zelda was about was a lot more, closer to the original. But in terms of the idea of, it's a fantasy game, you get to be this, sort of young swordsman, I kind of see it being more sort of visceral realization of that.
Well, moving on with some of the comments, Golden Phoenix was actually one of the few people to post in the thread saying that they don't like the game. I was expecting more of that. Maybe we'll hear from John after E3 on his Zelda 2 thoughts. But Golden Phoenix said, I really do not like the game. It's a mishmash of RPG elements and side-scrolling, and none of it works.
I'd say that's harsh. To say none of it works.
It does work, but in some cases it doesn't work.
But to say that none of it works,
I guess the big problem with the RPG element, maybe for some people, is that, for instance, as we talked about with the whole life thing that it's tied to, this is not Dragon Quest in any sense. It's not just gonna reward you for playing it at all. Like, you are gonna have to, like kind of Johnny said, you're gonna have to achieve something by actually, managing to get to the next level without dying and things like that. So it's quite different from that kind of like, oh well, if you play it for long enough, you'll kind of pass by default.
Right. It's much more difficult than a game like Dragon Quest.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean, one of the ideas behind RPGs like Dragon Quest is that anyone could play. That's part of the reason they became so popular in Japan, is that, even housewives who didn't know much about games could beat Dragon Quest, because it doesn't really take skill to play it.
It's just a matter of
time.
Eventuality, yeah.
Skill might save you some time, but it's not required. And it most definitely required for Zelda
2.
Yeah,
so it is quite, it definitely is, it's an RPG element, but its employment is very different.
Mm-hmm. Moving on with the remainder of Golden Phoenix's post, quote, "The dungeon designs are pathetic. Besides a few palette and color swaps, they all look virtually the same. with little to distinguish each room.
Mm, yeah, so is that an issue later on if they get, like, you know, like, in terms of navigation, because you don't
it
have...
It does become... It's more of a one of these games where you might want to sketch out a map, yeah, unless you've played it so many times that you kind of have a mental idea of generally where things are. I mean, the good thing is the dungeons typically aren't that large, right, so you might not literally have to draw something, but in your head, you're going to have to keep track of a little bit. And I don't think the dungeon designs are pathetic. I think they're actually pretty interesting even late in the game, but graphically, it makes it artificially difficult because, yeah, the graphics aren't, they're not detailed enough to help you distinguish one room from the next.
Yeah, the only problem I had with the dungeon designs are that on some floors there are intentional dead ends, and it's just annoying just to go back to square one and then just trying to navigate with the elevator, if the dungeon has the elevator, mm-hmm, to see where you have to go to get the key or something.
But in the game's defense, generally the enemies don't reset, even if you die.
That's true, yeah, and so, that continue, like, over those three lives, obviously, which is what's important, that, which I guess is kind of important, because otherwise you could almost, like, abuse it in some way for the experience, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Like, you could deliberately, mm-hmm, you could deliberately die, like, in front, so you could do a room full of, like, experience-yielding monsters again, and then pass the next level, and then, you know, you don't... Yeah, so you've sort of secured that at least just for the price of one life or something. So I guess it had to do it that way, but it's definitely nice, yeah, that it does.
Like, you can definitely grind on the overworld.
Yeah, on the overworld, sure.
It's much less efficient than going into a temple and really making it count in the temple, because the enemies in the temple are worth more.
Way
but they
more.
Don't automatically respawn.
It's very, so, very much more significant, isn't it? Like, your average little...
There's a risk-reward,
like,
there that I kind of like, actually.
Yeah, in the dungeons, I personally hate the enemies that resemble the Castlevania Medusa heads, because when they hit you, they actually drain your EXP.
Experience points, yeah.
Which is very, very annoying, and I don't think you can kill them with your sword. They just get stunned.
No, you can.
Oh, but it'll probably...
You should upgrade your attack.
Oh, but it probably takes forever.
They are definitely not invincible, and actually, as you get later in the game, you'll get to where you can just kind of kill them in one hit. Although, you know, it's safer to just try to avoid them. But the good thing is they come in a predictable pattern, but it is definitely, you're definitely right to compare it to Medusa heads in that they typically put them in places where they're difficult to avoid. You know, you have to kind of be really, really vigilant in order to not get hit by those guys. It's tough. They're easier once you get the down strike. In fact, I think the combat of the game just gets overall more fun once you get down strike, because it opens up such drastically different attack
strategies.
It just makes combat flow better a little bit. You know, it makes it a little more jumpy, a little more fast paced, I think.
Mm.
A little less defensive, maybe.
Yeah, because I mean, I guess that's the thing. What can happen? We talked about the tension aspect. We talked about, you know, the kind of defensive aspect and so forth. What this can all mean, you know, when you're sitting on a lot of experience points that you don't want to have wasted, is the game can slow down a lot, you know, because you're very trepidatious, you play conservatively and so forth. So I guess, you know, as it goes on, you're able to break out of that a little more. That would be nice, just speed up the pace.
You can.
Yeah.
You can, within reason. Gojira posted, "The way Link controls is very fun. Running around, jumping, and attacking in this game has always been great, but the weird experience / live / continue system takes some getting used to. Plus, Link's sword has always felt very short. But fighting the skeletons and knights is very satisfying."
I didn't know you posted under a second name, Johnny.
Yeah, well, you know, it's. I mean, I think that the whole experience lives continue thing is very... I mean, what other game works like this? I can't name one. I mean, I don't know. Maybe Battle Olympus that you mentioned. I have no idea how that works. Or
I don't remember. But you know, I think there is reason for it.
What I mean is, you definitely do have to get used to it, because you haven't played it like that. You haven't played something that works this way before. Yeah. In all likelihood, you know. Yeah. Whereas most everything else, you know, is pretty... either pretty transparent, or you've done it before, literally, you know, like in something else, something similar. So it's very true that you kind of have to wrap your head around just how the game works, what it's asked, you know, what's important, really, as well. You know,
me.
Yeah, and the one thing is, his animation cracks me up, the way when he runs. He's got this weird little sort of compacted gallop that he does. It's very funny.
I was going to say trot, but
yes,
yeah, gallop.
It is a little, it's a little gallop, but it's very confined, you know. So
it makes me think of Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
It
the
is a bit,
the
yeah.
I mean,
the whole.
It does kind of look like that, you know.
Yeah, that's good fun.
Anyway, let's see. The last forum post I have for today is from Sundalos, and he posted, "One thing that struck me, the game's backgrounds and color palette are far more bland and Spartan than I remember. I'm far more fond of some of the enemy character sprites, though. I still think the Gorias, Stalfos, Iron Knuckles, Lizardmen, Bird Knights, etc. look very, very cool. As a kid, I was so taken with the whole Zelda mythos that I love seeing these guys return in the game." I think he has a nice point there. I mean, definitely the backgrounds are atrocious. I mean, it's kind of typical NES.
There's nothing to them, is there really? It's really bad.
Well, yeah. It's really a consequence of the NES, since everything was so primitive and not powerful. I think they wanted to focus on the enemy designs rather than making...
Definitely.
Yeah, like memorable levels or something.
I guess, I mean, later on, a little later on in the, you know, if you get to the real end of the 80s, you know, you start getting some more ambitious stuff with NES, you know.
Yeah.
Your Castlevania 3s, your Super Mario 3s, you know, they started, but a lot of that was special stuff in the cartridge and all that. You know, this was still back in the sort of Famicom disk system era in Japan, so you hadn't got to that point yet, and I mean, it's
just really a consequence of the times.
It's funny because you never really feel like the NES topped itself out. Every time you did, something else came out, and you're like, wow, that seems like
because I guess the base tech was, like, extremely primitive, and we're talking about something that came out in 83 in Japan.
Yeah, and they just kept adding on
and
to
it wasn't
the
really cutting edge then, you know, in many ways. So
it didn't need to be.
No, it certainly didn't. But, of course, what they did is they kept putting stuff in stuff in the cartridges, and, you know...
Which, if you think about it, is ingenious.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They had to do it.
I don't think we've seen such a wide range in what a system outputs.
You mean so from start to finish? Well, maybe not, because I mean, you think of how primitive.
There's a pretty wide range on Wii.
There's a pretty
that's just due to poor development.
You wait until Mad Dog McCree shows up on Wii, then we'll have a wide range.
Look, when that game shows up, it's on the John Haster review list.
We've got Target Terror, Mad Dog McCree, Chicken Shoe, you know, and then of course you got
the Conduit in Mario Kart.
Yeah, you got so there's a broad, but you know, I mean, you're talking about the earliest stuff was way more primitive than Zelda 2. I mean, there's still a pretty big advancement there.
Yeah, I mean, there was some stuff on the early NES that you would swear came from an Atari.
There is some Atari-looking stuff from the first couple years, for sure.
But it's not as prevalent or bad.
No, I'm sure it wasn't.
You know, Zelda 2 maybe doesn't get enough credit for what it does achieve graphically. I mean, the backgrounds are, you know, like I said, they're single-color backgrounds. They're really bad.
Yeah.
But I think there are elements of what it does that are easy to overlook now, but I mean, you think about, this is a scrolling game, whereas the first Zelda is not. It was one screen at a time, Pac-Man stuff. And Zelda 2 is a scrolling game like Mario. That alone was a major advancement. I mean, it was pioneered by Super Mario Brothers, of course.
And of course, you didn't have the whole thing. Like, so many games at that time, they would have just kind of scrolled in one direction even. You know, this was actually a pretty hard constraint at the time, whereas, I mean, it seems to scroll in both directions fine.
It does, absolutely. Occasionally in Zelda 2, you'll see an enemy kind of split between both sides of the screen really on the edge, but that's a minor graphical bug. You don't even see it.
I mean,
that
Capcom
often
couldn't even get that shit straight all the way up to the Resident Evil series, so I'm not going to hold them accountable for this.
But hey, if you want an explanation of why Zelda 2 looks the way it does, it was probably Nintendo saying, well, we can't very well turn around and make another one screen at a time Zelda game. Now that we've done this side-scrolling Mario thing, this is the new hotness. How can we apply this to Zelda?
I would like to never hear you use that phrase to describe Mario games ever again.
Okay,
sorry.
But you know, I think that Sundalos makes a great point about the characters. I mean, the character animation isn't the most amazing thing, but the character art and the designs of them are so evocative. And there's actually a pretty impressive amount of variety in the kinds of enemies that you meet. And even, you know, people make fun of the townspeople.
No, the townspeople make fun of the townspeople.
Well, I'm talking about the art. You know, they are very iconic character art in the towns, and there are, you know, I mean, some character designs don't show up in every town, but there are overall probably 8 or 10 different people. And that's a lot for a game of this time. I mean, that's a lot of different, you know, I mean, think about the first Zelda, every character in the game looked the same. It was all the old man, right? And in this game, you even have multiple kinds of old men. So
and women.
So are you saying Hyrule is actually a retirement community?
I think you have 4 different, like, ladies, you know, like towns ladies.
I got more than that.
I like the ones that help healed you or healed your magic, and in order to do that, you had to enter the house.
Mm-hmm.
Very unintentionally funny.
One thing that that's definitely worth mentioning is the music, which I don't think Koji Kondo had anything to do with, but it is very good. I think I like the music quite a lot.
I
think it sounds a little wonky because I'm playing the PAL version, which I'm not happy about. I'm not happy that, as people will know by now, it's not my preferred way to play Trinity, you know, the retro games, but it's still really good. I've heard it, you know, everywhere over the years in various, you know, rearrangements or OC remix or, you know, Smash Brothers. I mean, you've heard all these melodies, and it's kind of funny to place them actually, but they're really good. Actually, everything with the overworld and the caves, and it's all great. And the town, actually, it's all
temple music is great.
It's all really, really good. And you know, like I said, I didn't have because I don't really think after Miyamoto supposedly kind of laid down the concept that there was much commonality between the development on the first one and the second one, you know, including Koji Kondo.
No.
So yeah, it was pretty much a new bunch of people, but on the music end, I think they held it up pretty well.
Yeah, and did you notice the excessive, extreme amount of vibrato in the music? the instruments that they're, and TYP will appreciate this, he'll know what I'm talking about, but the instruments that they're using in this game. when I first booted it up, you know, a couple weeks ago, I was like, oh my god, this, like, every note has vibrato.
Yeah,
it
does.
Out of control.
What's interesting to me is that, like, because it would have been like a Famicom Disk System game, like the first one, like the Famicom Disk System had an extra channel or something. So, like, the cartridge version would have been a little pared down from that. It'd be kind of interesting to hear what it sounds like in its original form, which I could do if I downloaded it for the Japanese one, which in retrospect, you know, I probably could have just done that because there's text.
I don't think you're getting much out of the translation.
You know, like, go west when I don't even really mean that. it's not quite the sort of Castlevania active deception or just incomprehensible nonsense about graveyard ducks, but it's close.
Yeah, it's close. I think the kind of randomly placed secret tiles on the overhead world are more of a problem than the confusing text.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. Like, there's a part quite early on
you have to fucking explore that.
Yeah,
map.
There's a part early on where you try. There's the guy. You need to get the guy so they'll let you go over the bridge. And, you know, you're kind of just fumbling around in the forest somewhere, and it's like there's a bunch of tiles that are just like forest tiles, so you just end up fighting some enemies. But one of them is the guy's house. And it's just kind of not transparent at all. It's kind of, you know, it's all a bit aimless.
Very, very 8-bit.
Later on,
that's how you find a lot of the heart containers and, you know, extra experience bags and things
like
that.
I guess it's all kind of the suite of things at the time, you know. When you say it's very 8-bit, I think the most crucial sense of that is, you know, dragging the whole thing out. You know, because that's what 8-bit games did. So they dragged stuff out. And, you know, making you want to explore every tile is a sort of classic way of dragging it out, isn't it? You know, because there might be a heart container there, or there might be a magic thing there, or whatever.
And that's also a very Miyamoto kind of thing, you know, wanting you to find the secret cave, right?
Where giving you a reason to look everywhere, you know. I mean, it is true. It's still something that sort of pervades with Zelda today to an extent, but it tends to be more kind of obviously kind of tiered in terms of like the
stuff. There's more logic to how those things are distributed in more modern
Zeldas.
And
just like in terms of importance, like, you know, there's the kind of trivial stuff and then the useful stuff and then the important stuff, which is very clearly sort of delineated.
Right. Okay, well, I think we're going to end it there, and we will suspend the Zelda 2 conversation until after E3, but the forum thread will remain open, and those of you who haven't gotten in there yet to leave your thoughts, I hope you will. Those of you who already have, I hope you'll continue to discuss it. We've had some pretty nice little sub-threads of discussion in that thread. It's actually, I said this last time, it is my favorite retroactive thread so far. I think it's been the most interesting. So I hope you'll at least go check it out and read through it, even if you don't have anything to add. But yeah, we'll be back with Zelda 2 after E3, and we'll hear from John and get his
very constructive,
his maybe marriage will mellow him out.
He'll give us a box quote for Zelda 2.
Yes, a 20-year-old box quote.
Yeah,
he was reviewing games back then anyway. It's fine.
Yeah.
All right. So I actually want to take a break here, and we will be back with a bit of listener mail right after this. Okay, we're back for a very quick listener mail segment. It's been a while since we did this, and I definitely wanted to include some before E3 because it's not happening next week, suffice it to say. So we did want to catch up on your listener mails, and James is reading the first one.
So Steve from Kenosha, Wisconsin writes, I just wanted to let you guys know that you do great work. I don't want to sound fanboyish, but RFN is one of the best podcasts out there. I'll save all the reasons why for my iTunes review. But to give personal kudos, the simple fact that you add those awesome graphics and essentially chapter breaks, well, they're chapter breaks, is like that extra polish I look for in games.
James is trying to read this through the tears.
It's hard, man.
It's just...
I know you guys put a lot of work effort into this site and more or less into your spare time, and I greatly appreciate it. Oh, yeah. And listening to your podcast has actually got me interested in Wii stuff again.
Really? Well, more I'm surprised, you know, with some of the topics. Dead Space multiple times, you know. Resistance
Light Gun Games.
Killzone 2.
Well, he said the podcast, not necessarily John.
Oh, burn.
Go on.
Well, more like VC stuff. Okay, well, so there we go. That's the problem. Never mind. You should have let me read the next sentence. We'd have been fine. I'm excited to start playing Zelda 2 or Star Tropics with you guys, both games which I have not played. Well, guess what? It was Zelda 2, and you're probably not excited anymore.
First, thanks to Steve. That's really kind of you to say, and I'm glad that people recognize the effort that goes into things like the AAC version with all the photos and the chapter breaks. And James really... Well, I think Mike...
Carl did it, but Carl was using GarageBand,
it was easier back then. But you can put in a chapter break wherever you like, whereas James had to devise a different method, which I've inherited.
Yes, I tried to make it as simple for a handover as possible, and I still think it was maniacally difficult to explain originally what the hell is going on.
Well, you know, we do nicely there, but always make sure that the pictures are formatted for the right thing and everything. We've got some pretty awesome pictures lately of chubby guys being very excited that they got their DSi, for instance.
Oh my god!
Well, you know, it was funny
at it sometimes. We had for John becoming director of the site. I had King Conan, you know, where he's on the throne with the with his hand resting under his chin. You know, get the advanced version. There are more jokes.
Yeah, there are. And I think Carl's probably when I first started doing the pictures, they were like really hardcore. Like, this is an image from the game. And then as I became more and more annoyed with editing, they just became more and more just cynical images.
You had a great one for introspection. I remember that.
Oh, what was it?
It was the, you know, it was someone's sort of face detached, so it was looking at themselves.
Oh.
I just got, I can remember because I wrote the chapter name, which was Introspection is Our Business. And
oh,
then
yes.
You added the picture. And I thought, God, that's perfect. I was really pleased with that.
See, there's a whole other dimension to this podcast that a lot of people don't even realize is there.
Well, see, as you edit it, you become more intimately aware of everything that's going on in it. And it almost becomes the point where you're like, I need to make fun of this, but we've already recorded, so I can't add my making fun of it to the podcast. So the picture or the chapter name or the episode title are good ways to make fun of some of the stuff that happens in the course of the show.
All right. Well, thanks again to Steve, and I hope you have been playing Zelda 2, and I hope you're enjoying it. And Star Tropics is not dead, by the way. I mean, that was so close. That will definitely be coming up in the sort of the retroactive number 10 roundup, where we kind of go back to the popular runners-up from previous polls. So that will come back. I can't guarantee that it'll win, but it will get another chance for sure. So Luke has the next one.
All right. The next one is from Grant in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey guys, love the podcast, but I'm not one to write in off. I have a suggestion that I hope some of you will take me up on in regards to WiiWare. I really think you should try Lost Winds. With the praise that you all gave Super Metroid, you will certainly love the map design of this game, and it's necessary to get new power-ups and moves in order to reach previously inaccessible areas. It's a lot like Metroid, actually, except zen-like and rather calming instead of intense. Anywho, give it a try. Why don't ya?
I'd like to make one comment here. Mm. He says you'll certainly love the map design. He did mean singular, because there's only, what, an hour and a half of gameplay?
Yeah.
It's not a expansive game.
No.
Yeah, in a way, I don't want to discount him, but a lot of people probably tried it out considering it was a launch WiiWare game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it certainly had a lot of exposure, especially to early adopters of the WiiWare service who wanted to try out what the service offers.
I'm sure it did. I mean, I didn't try it, and I was kind of tempted and never got around to it, but... I might go for it. I mean, at some point, you know, because the storage thing has been solved and all that, and I do like those kinds of games. So even though it's probably not the most enticing value proposition, you know, I mean, I could see giving it a go.
I still think it's a bit overpriced. Yeah, I mean, it's my kind of game too, and I think I said this about a year ago, but I did end up getting to play this at Wendy's house when I was there for E3 last year, and I sat there for about an hour and ended up playing through the majority of the game.
Oh, fair enough.
Just, I sat down just to kind of sample it and just check it out, and you know, it held my interest for an hour. You know, I didn't just immediately move on and look at something else, so obviously I enjoyed it, but I've almost beaten it just in that time, so...
Well, it's definitely not very worth it for you then, to
buy it again. Yeah, I'm not very tempted to go ahead and pay $10 for it now, but sure. I agree, you can draw the comparison between this and a Metroid style of game, but it feels very different. I feel like the controls are far more detached, because, you know, all you do with the main character is walk and jump, and everything else is controlled by the wind.
The point,
and
right.
It's a cool idea, and it's a good use of the Wii technology, but at the same time, I found it to be very floaty, and I didn't really like the control. Maybe it wasn't even so much the control, but it was just kind of the way that the physics worked, or the way that the wind blew was not precise enough for me, whereas like in Kirby Canvas Curse on DS... different input device, obviously, but a similar idea. To me, it works much better in that game. Maybe it's fine tuning, you know.
Yeah,
but,
and Kirby's Canvas Curse was more fleshed out compared to Lost.
Oh, it's quite a big game. Yeah, really.
By
yeah.
far. Yeah,
really quite good. That's one of the go back to last week. That's one of the things that Hal's done since Iwata took the big chair.
God, yeah. I wish they would do more stuff.
I think
like
what
that.
They've done more recently actually is Pokemon Ranger. Funnily enough, which doesn't really seem like the kind of thing they do, but
Anyway, so Greg has
the... Yeah, so this is from Ryan in Anaheim, California, and also on the topic of WiiWare, he says, I don't recall being mentioned, one game I don't recall being mentioned in episode 146 is Strong Bad's cool game for attractive people. I'm a fan of both Strong Bad and point-and-click adventures, so for me this was a high point in WiiWare's first year. Let's not forget it was also the first episodic game on a Nintendo system. So, James, you did you try any of these? You did, didn't you? Reviewed, like, where you got review code for some of them, or
I got a review code for we actually got review codes for all of them. I played the first two, and yeah, I mean they're reasonably entertaining if you enjoyed that franchise. I mean they're not highlights of the genre, but they're certainly serviceable titles. That's what I was to say about them.
The issue for me was the license.
Yeah, I mean it's a very
I really cannot stand Strong Bad and all that.
I remember
Homestar Runner.
I mean, I think it definitely would have been worth bringing up in terms of, well, because it was quite a sort of notable development in the first year for sure. Yeah, you know, these pretty significant episodes showing up once a month. And I think they've done pretty well sales wise, and they had a little renaissance when they fixed the storage thing. So, you know, it'd be easy to see if anybody else sort of takes up the episodic baton.
Well,
different kinds of games.
FF4 The After Years.
Yeah,
is probably
of course.
Going
isn't
to
that,
do
was
that?
How many is in there? In that, do we know?
Well, the cell phone version is 9 episodes. I'm really keenly hoping that the WiiWare version will maybe be 3 at a time, 3 per package or something.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, that's going to turn into a very expensive game.
Presumably, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I personally don't think it'll follow the cell phone way of distributing it, considering that they gave away the first game for free. But the catch was they had to sign on to the subscription plan where they had to pay for the rest of the games.
One issue I have with Strong Bad on WiiWare is that it's a bit expensive, especially when you combine
it
all together.
It's basically like a retail price game, right? Because it's 5 lots of 1,000 points, so it's $50 at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Right, and you know, maybe when you combine all the time together, it ends up being an 8-hour game, which is decent for
$50.
I would
say it winds
up
being a little bit longer than that, probably in the 10 to 12 range.
But my issue with it is that it was significantly less expensive on PC for exactly the same product. And I understand maybe that's Nintendo's fault, you know? But at the same time, it's really hard for me to justify paying $2 extra just to play it on Wii when I own a PC that would run it, you know? And the other thing is you could just kind of subscribe to all of them on PC so they'd automatically download and you'd get a group discount by doing that. Mm. I think you could buy the entire series for $30 on PC, whereas it's $50 on WiiWare. I mean, that is huge difference. So that was a bit off-putting for me, but I wouldn't have played it anyway because I hate Strong Bad. So the last question, or the last letter this week, comes from Miyamoto Megaton. Great name. And this character writes, "Hi, I listened to your E3 predictions and I wanted to expand on one of them. The old video game blog Surfer Girl got every rumor right on Retro Studios in the past, including the recently released Metroid Prime Trilogy. Her last rumor was that Retro is hard at work on a Zelda spinoff. My first impression assumes it's based on a character, but it could be the rumored A Link to the Past remake with a different play method or perspective. First-person Wii motion plus sword swinging perhaps to take Zelda back to its action roots, a la Zelda 2.
Yeah, if you want to call it its roots. it is in a manner of speaking. We recently had movement on this, didn't we, with what the IGN guys on their podcast were saying about how they had strong reason to believe that at one time Retro may well have been working on something Zelda related, but if they ever were, it is now dead in the water.
I haven't heard that.
But yeah, apparently this is what they were saying on the voice chat, that you know, that they had sort of received some sort of what they considered to be pretty credible information, but still in the rumor category, that this had been in the works at one point, but at some point had been shut down. So they wouldn't be working, so we wouldn't be seeing that at E3, obviously, if it didn't exist. But it's an intriguing idea because we talked about the similarities between Metroid Prime and Ocarina of Time when we did the Ocarina episode. So it's not such a leap to think of Retro taking on Zelda in some fashion at all. I think they could have done a good job of it in a way. And it would have been interesting to see what they would have done with it, not least from an art style perspective, bringing their
very
talented art staff to something that's, you know, a different kind of sort of fantastical environment than Metroid. I would have really liked to see that. So it's kind of a shame, maybe, that if that did at one time was on the table and then was taken off, it's kind of a shame. But
more than anything, I
just hope what Retro is doing is really great, whatever that may be.
I would say that if it was taken off the table, it probably wasn't progressing in a way that...
Maybe not. I mean, you're into mega speculation zone.
Yeah,
Ravenblade territory.
Yeah, no. But I mean, we don't even know this thing existed. I mean, exactly.
You are totally shooting in the dark.
But to go back to the email, I'm not inclined to put much stock in video game blogs. To be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, the rumors about Retro, or what rumors exactly?
Yeah, Surfer Girl, I'm not extremely familiar with. I mean, I've heard
it doesn't exist anymore, basically.
Yeah, it doesn't.
She packed it up.
Oh, okay. But from what I would read about on GAF and, you know, et cetera,
so it's
about
GAF,
Surfer Girl.
That you mean the NeoGAF?
The NeoGAF. And you know, it certainly came up on our site's forums as well, is that most of her predictions were pretty safe. It was things that, like, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that happened. That's kind
of sort of inherently plausible things that, you know.
Yeah, so, you know, you'd be surprised if some of these things didn't happen. So I don't think it was all that far-fetched, and that's the only thing I have to say about Surfer Girl. Was never very impressed by the risks taken with her wild predictions.
Yeah, well, I'm just excited to know what Retro are doing. I really hope that we get to hear about that very much. You know, it'd be even nicer for you guys if it were playable, obviously, because you'd be able to get your paws on it. But.
Okay, well, I guess that will wrap up the show. Want to thank Luke for guesting with us this week.
It's been a pleasure.
Nice job.
It's been a real pleasure, guys.
Cool, and especially for such a long episode, I appreciate you sticking with us throughout. Of course, congratulations to John Lindman. By the time you hear this, he will be a married man, and we wish him the very best and have a great honeymoon. And you can send your emails, of course, to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We will get back to the mailbag after E3. So anything you want to comment on this show or the proceedings at E3 next week, if you want to hear our comments on those or give your own, you can send those in and we will get to them as soon as it is reasonable. And, of course, look forward to E3 shows next week. I'm hoping to have one every day of the week. We shall see. At least, you know, Monday through Thursday, probably. It's going to be a logistical challenge, so we'll see how it goes. I'm not promising anything, but that is what I hope. And I look forward to doing it in person and have some new people on there. So it's going to be exciting. E3, of course, check out NintendoWorldReport.com and get the most up-to-date, up-to-the-minute coverage of that. So with that, we're going to end the show. Thank you very much for listening. See you next week.
Later.
Bye-bye.
Later.
Speaking of something that sounds oddly sexual, in Majora's Mask this week, I got the rabbit hood.
Okay.
And nothing.
I think that's hilarious.
Crickets.
But okay, whatever.
No, all right,
move on, James.
So,
please, continue.
I'll just cut the pause out and it'll sound like they got it.
But we did. But you didn't get it either.
Oh no! But I didn't. I didn't laugh the second time either.
The rabbit hood. It's a condom with a vibrator on the end of it. God, you people.
Oh, God, you and your depraved jargon.
You know what? I have no doubt that when John said he's excited to get our Japanese Wii and he's going to download that game, that he plans to do it. Like,
oh, absolutely.
Like, there's not a doubt in my mind. John is legitimately excited to get to play Muscle March.
Absolutely.
And can you blame him?
He's getting married just for cover.
I didn't want to go there.
That's his cover story.
That's a good one.